Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC. And Safety Insurance, offering a variety of home insurance products to cover your home's increased value. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, thousands of rioters incited by President Trump's rhetoric stormed the Capitol building Wednesday. In the ensuing chaos, four people died. The police, unprepared, were overrun as rioters and looters walked through the Capitol building with ease. Late in the evening, Congress resumed its duties and formally recognized Joe Biden as the next president. We'll talk to the Washington Post's E.J. Dionne about all this, and then we'll be taking your calls throughout the show.
When a team of experts at the Transition Integrity Project gamed out every possible election scenario, they predicted a giant mess. Barring an overwhelming Biden win, their analysis showed threats of violence in the streets, and that prediction played out in real time Wednesday as thousands of pro-Trump protesters and rioters stormed the Capitol building to disrupt Congress certification of the election results. Rosa Brooks, co-organizer of that Transition Integrity Project, will join us to discuss ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Houston Bradley, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
Well, it's unbelievable, isn't it? What a 24 hours.
All day, all night long, absolutely incredible.
Well, you know, the only thing I'm sitting here thinking and reading, the only thing worse than yesterday, which is about as bad as it gets, is the guy that caused it and the guy who doesn't give a damn that another 4,000 people died yesterday on his watch from COVID-19 still has his job. But we shall see. In 2016, President Trump said he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and still not lose votes. Yesterday, Trump basically put that theory to the test. By encouraging violence, mayhem, destruction, Trump urged his supporters to storm the Capitol, where one woman was shot and killed and three others died after being injured amid the chaos. The bloodshed backfired on Trump, though. Instead of voting to overturn the election results, the majority of Congress, as you know, at about 3:30 this morning, decided to vote for the soul of America. Joining us on the line for his take on this, what the Democratic victory, which nobody has talked about in Georgia, means for Biden and the era of Trump, and more, is E.J. Dionne. E.J. is a columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. E.J., great to talk to you, particularly today. Welcome.
It is always so good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
EJ, we're going to get to Georgia because poor Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, they got totally lost in what happened yesterday, obviously. But we'll get to that in a second because we want to talk about that too. But before that, obviously, what did you think about? You've been a reporter for years covering Washington. What's your reaction to what happened yesterday?
Well, I mean, we have, in my life, and I think in yours too, we have never seen anything like this. The notion of our Capitol being invaded by extremists, Trump flags. There is one case, Chris Van Hollen, the senator from Maryland, pointed this out during the debate over the election, having an American flag replaced by a Trump flag, I think may have said everything about what was going on yesterday. Somebody else commented today that this was un-American because it was anti-democratic, small d, but it was not non-American because there is this strain of extremism, of right-wing extremism in the country. I want to just go where Jim started when he talked about this backfiring on Trump. I think at a moment when we are all very blue and worried and concerned, and rightly so, about what happened at the Capitol, Jim noted that it backfired on Trump, and I think that's very important to the future. I don't want to be my cliched self of being a glass one-tenth full sort of person, but I do, and we've talked about that before. But I think it's really important that this really did backfire. For one thing, when the voting came in the Senate, a bunch of the senators who said they were going to vote to support Trump's nonsensical challenge to this election backed off and went the other way. I think a bunch of Republicans, like Mitt Romney in particular, that was a very powerful speech he gave, and I've been critical of Romney in many ways over the years, but that was a really powerful moment backed up by his vote for impeachment. And lastly, let me bring up Georgia, because, yeah, maybe I'm being a bit too optimistic, but I really think that we can't let the extremists overshadow what happened in Georgia last night, on Tuesday and before. Extraordinary black turnout, the organizing efforts by Stacey Abrams and others, what happens when Democrats have a clear economic message, and the ongoing suburban rejection of Trumpism. The Republicans were hoping that once Trump was gone, some of those suburban voters would come home. They didn't. Now, none of that gets rid of the stain or the danger represented by what happened at the Capitol. But there is a way in which we might end up over the long term looking at this as the last gasp of an ugly moment rather than a sign of things to come. And again, a lot of these extremists are still going to be out there. It's not going to be easy for Joe Biden. But I think that it was a sign of weakness more than strength that Trump ended up having to resort to this, truly horrible attack on democracy.
Yeah, let's talk, as Marjorie said, let's talk a little bit more about Georgia and a little bit more about the long-term impact of yesterday, E.J. Dionne. But first, what does happen to Trump in the final 13 days? There were reports, as I'm sure you're aware, and listeners are, that some higher-ups, including a few White House-connected, were talking 25th Amendment removal for inability to fulfill his duties, which obviously has to be started by the vice president, who, after 4 years of sycophancy, finally, actually, he wasn't courageous. What he did was he complied with his constitutional obligations. This 25th Amendment talk is just talk, correct?
That's my sense. I've heard the theory that it's partly an effort by people inside to tell Trump, this is what you're up against, cool it until January 20th, and that it's a pushback against him. I am all for all of the proposals to remove him, either by impeachment or the 25th Amendment, not because I think they are likely to happen. I don't think they are likely to happen, but because they will put pressure on Trump to leave. Again, I think what we have to look at is, again, the horror of this married to the fact that an awful lot of people who spent 4 years trying to say, oh, don't take him literally, take him seriously, and all of that, have been forced by the events of the last 24 hours to say, no, this guy really was as bad, as selfish, as anti-democratic, as all of his critics said. And again, I think that has long-term impact on the ability of Trumpism to survive as a movement, and the ability of Trump to interfere in our politics. And I use that term intentionally, interfere in our politics after he is gone. Look at what happened at the standing of Josh Hawley within 48 hours. Josh Hawley thought he was jumping on a horse that would get him to the presidency, and the horse just collapsed underneath him, if I can use that metaphor. I think that's very important. And again, it's awful, but maybe going forward, this was the inoculation, something that's very much on our mind. Maybe this was the vaccine we needed.
By the way, for those who are not paying attention, all the players, Hawley's the young Republican senator from Missouri, who was the first among them to say that he would lead the challenge to some of the electors, which obviously didn't go very far yesterday. We're talking to E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post.
There's a picture of him raising his fist to the protesters as he walked into the Capitol, which I think will be replayed. But you know something, E.J. Dionne?
Just, Marjorie, that picture is so important. What that picture meant 48 hours ago and what it means now is so, so different. And that's almost precisely what I am talking about.
You know, while we're talking, I just got an email from one of our listeners who wanted to know if these were really Trump supporters or whether these were Antifa people. And I mentioned that, EJ, because you've been a reporter for a long time. And, Newsmax and ONA, that whatever it is, One American Network, whatever it is, right? They are blaming yesterday on Antifa and left-wing activists.
Sean Hannity did it, too. Don't leave Fox News out of this.
Well, I hadn't gotten to him yet. The left-wing activists, the media, even the cops at the Capitol for starting a so-called civil war in America. I was back and forth on Fox last night, and Sean Hannity was talking about that the urgent push for election integrity has to go on, that he was talking about Hillary's Russian dossier and Ukraine and Hunter Biden and all these things. So part of me feels as though, the problem here is that there's this whole world of lies and conspiracies that millions and millions and millions of Americans, including our emailer, are buying into. And I don't know how you fix that.
It's very worrisome, I think the whole 4 years we've just gone through have been characterized by the term astonishing but not surprising. Every time something like this happens, every time these lies get told, we are astonished that so many people believe them, but we should not be surprised because there's a minority of Americans who are looking only at right-wing media and are prepared to believe whatever is convenient. Now, let's be fair. All of us have a certain information bias, and we tend to look for the information that confirms our view. But I think this is really prominent on the right wing, on the right end of our political spectrum now. In a way, it's not on the left end of, on the moderate or left end of our spectrum. But here's the thing. In order to hold up their story, the claims have to get more and more absurd. If all of those people were Antifa people, they have the best costume designers and actors recruitment that I've ever seen. There was nothing when you looked at that that said these are Antifa people. Every picture said these are supporters of Donald Trump, thousands of them. They were people who showed up at Donald Trump's rally. I do not think there are even enough Antifa people to show up at a Trump rally like that. So the fact that they are being pushed into a corner of making claims that are more and more absurd. Again, I think 20% of Americans are going to believe this. I was looking at data from the 50s and 60s. 8 or 10% of people had a favorable view of the John Birch Society. Joe McCarthy had a 35% favorable rating, 35% favorable rating. There is a right wing, there is a far right in America. The question is, do they become more marginalized and identified as the extremists that they actually are? And I think there's a real shot at that. And I think Biden's response, by the way, at least for me, and yes, I'm biased, I was happy to vote for Joe Biden, but I thought it was very reassuring. And I think a lot of Americans on the fence say, yeah, he sure looks more like a president than that other guy.
So 13 days to go, no 25th Amendment removal in your estimation, no impeachment and conviction. Maybe he resigns, but if he doesn't, Marjorie and I were talking before the show, EJ, I was really worried about starting a war. And Marjorie has convinced me that with the 10, every one of the living defense secretaries basically putting out this clarion call to their successor at the Pentagon and military officials apparently not ready to go along with him, that I shouldn't worry about wars. If you agree with her, what should one worry about other than an endless continuing succession of pardons in the final almost 2 weeks of Donald Trump?
Yeah, who knew that Dick Cheney would briefly be somebody praised by, a whole side of the political world that has been so critical of him? He showed how much damage he can do after yesterday. I think the support for some of the extreme statements he's making dropped rather sharply within his own party. So I think he's more cornered in that respect. You're seeing some of these last-minute resignations, kind of deathbed conversions in his administration, so that I think that his influence on his own government is being reduced by the day, which is why I'm inclined to agree with Margie. The only thing that holds me back is, anytime you say, well, it can't get worse than this under the Trump presidency, something happens and it does, like yesterday. So, you know, I'm guarded in what I say, but I think his power, power is really sapping away. And I don't think our military is in any way going to be complicit with any of the moves that he might want to make to stay in office. I think those defense secretaries were important, not just because they said it, but because I think they speak for an awful lot of people in the military.
You know, E.J. Dionne, may I move on to Merrick Garland here? Because I wanted to ask E.J. about Biden's nominee for Attorney General. Of course, Merrick Garland was the judge that Barack Obama nominated for the Supreme Court, who never got very far in his attempt to become a Supreme Court justice. You wrote a case about him saying he'd be a great Attorney General. You also said you'd known him since college. How have you known him since college?
We went to college together.
I have known him.
We went to college together. He was a year behind me, I guess. And we were friends back then. And as I said in that column, I was reluctant to write it because obviously I am biased as someone who knew him. But the reason I decided to write it is just everybody who's known Merrick Garland for a long time knows how much the word integrity really defines him. I mean, if you want a straight arrow, there are few people that I have known for that long who are more straight arrows than Merrick Garland. And I wrote that column because I felt that after the experience of Attorney General Barr, you needed someone who would be utterly trustworthy, trusted across the political spectrum,
yeah,
known for his integrity or her integrity, in this case it was him, and who could put the Justice Department back together. And I also thought that it's very important that you establish that the Justice Department is not the president's Justice Department. It's the Justice Department for the whole country. And that Merrick Garland, by virtue of his standing and his experience, will be an independent attorney general. And there are going to be really tough calls that have to be made, not the least of which is, what do you do with the lawlessness of the Trump era? What is the right thing to do about that? I think you needed someone with the kind of respect that Merrick has across the spectrum to be trusted to make those judgments. No one's going to be able to say that Garland is, I mean, people will say it, but it would just will not have credibility that Garland is being a partisan here. I wrote that column because I felt at this moment he happened to be exactly the right person to try to put the Justice Department back together.
You know, that is a great question, E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post. I mean, many people were furious with Barack Obama for lots of things, but one of them is not going after prosecuting any of the big wigs on Wall Street for the horrible recession we went through in 2007, 2008. What should happen? I mean, Biden has indicated that he's not that keen on going after Trump. We have the New York Manhattan DA's office and the Attorney General, but what should happen to the
Attorney
president?
General, New York.
I got to say, I have been very torn on this question. I think like a lot of people are, on the one hand, it's not great in a free democratic republic for the next government in to prosecute the previous president, the leader of the previous movement. We hated people like me hated the lock her up cries for Hillary, within the Trump rallies against Hillary. On the other hand, one of the reasons we hated those cries is Hillary didn't do anything illegal, whereas yeah. There is going to, I think, just the very incitement that we saw this week could easily be prosecuted as an illegal act. His call, I tipped over more toward you really have to hold him accountable side with that call to Georgia that Trump made, saying basically find me 11,000 plus votes so I can go over the top against Joe Biden. That is, I think, a blatantly illegal act that he undertook. I think in some ways the best thing that could happen is for Trump to be prosecuted not by the federal government, but by these other prosecutors who are not under in any way under Joe Biden's control. But I think we're going to need accountability of some kind, because you can't let a president who breaks the law go unaccountable. And again, I think Garland has the both the standing and the concern for both democracy and justice to try to balance these interests as we go forward. But I think every day has made it more likely that Trump is going to have to be held accountable.
We're talking to E.J. Dionne. E.J., last thought is, I want to get back to where you started. I think your slight optimism about how yesterday may actually, in the long run, be a plus for a more, let's call it, collaborative government. That's my terminology, not yours. And if you disagree with how I'm characterizing you, please let me know. But if assuming you believe that, and yesterday was so outrageous that a handful of Republicans who've been on the wrong side of bipartisanship say, we got to show that this is one nation. What are the things that you would have Biden put before Congress first so that the country can see a Congress that for the most part works together for their interests?
Well, one of the reasons that I thought Georgia was so important is I don't have high expectations of the Republicans going forward, with a few exceptions. I think that they will still be obstructionists. Look at all those votes in the House to overturn the election results. And I, even though Mitch McConnell did the right thing in this case, I don't think he's inclined to make life easy for Joe Biden. But having the majority in the Senate, however thin, means that the Democrats control the agenda. They control the committees. And so I think that Biden, right out of the box, I think the House is going to pass some political reform, voting rights, democracy reform. I think over time we got to fight for those things to make sure the system works over the long run. But I think Biden himself is going to focus on the core issues that bother the country, which is get rid of this virus, get people vaccinated, and get the economy moving again. Those $2,000 checks were an essential issue down in Georgia. And I think Biden now has the capacity to pass some very substantial get the economy moving again bills, you know, both to provide specific relief to the unemployed and others, but also to for a larger infrastructure kind of program that's a green infrastructure program. I think that has reach across the political spectrum. I think expanding health coverage at a time of pandemic, providing people with adequate child care. I think there are a lot of issues on the progressive agenda that are mainstream kind of issues. And the bills themselves may not be exactly how the progressive end of the party want them written. It might be, it'll be expansions of Obamacare, not single payer. But I think there's a lot of room for Biden, with the very narrow majority he has, using some of the procedures available where you don't need 60 votes in the Senate, I think he can make a lot of progress in the next 6 months. And on a set of ideas that the Georgia election showed are broadly popular.
Let's hope you're right. EJ, it's great to talk to you, particularly
Great
day
to talk
like
to you again,
thanks
EJ.
So
I appreciate it.
So lovely to be with you always. Thanks so much.
Thank you. EJ Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. His latest book is Code Red: How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. EJ Dionne, Fuller Guy, it's great to talk to him. Coming up, law professor Rosa Brooks knew yesterday's violence was a likely outcome of the 2020 election. She joins us to talk about the unpeaceful transmission of power that she and her colleagues anticipated months ago. This is 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And before we move ahead, Marjorie, you and I were talking about Donald Trump's 12-hour ban from Twitter and 24-hour ban from Facebook and Instagram. Mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg just announced he is banned from, locked out of Facebook and Instagram till at least after the election. So Zuckerberg has taken action. I'm sorry, inauguration.
Oh, okay.
And Zuckerberg has taken pretty dramatic action, a little late, I would argue. Well, let's see how Dorsey does over there at Twitter. And by the way, he's not, to my knowledge, has not tweeted since his Twitter ban was lifted at 7 a.m. Over the summer, to gauge just how far Trump could push Democratic norms to stay in power, law professor Rosa Brooks co-founded the Transition Integrity Project. It was a bipartisan group of constitutional law experts and political insiders to game out a number of worst-case scenarios. Yesterday, we saw those scenarios materialize as that mob of Trump supporters staged an insurrection at the Capitol, storming the chambers of Congress, clashing with police, and leaving four people dead from the unrest. Rosa Brooks joins us online. She's a former Pentagon official in the Obama administration and the Scott K. Ginsburg Professor of Law and Public and Policy at Georgetown Law. Her forthcoming book is Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. Rosa Brooks, great to talk to you again.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Rosa. So I presume you were not that surprised by what happened yesterday, or maybe you were.
You know, Marjorie, I was simultaneously unsurprised and still shocked. I think that knowing, even as well as I did, how possible it was that things like what happened yesterday could happen, it still was shocking and upsetting. I live a few miles away from the Capitol, and we had a curfew. I live in Alexandria, Virginia. We had a curfew imposed at 6 p.m. as well. It's terrifying.
You know, one of the interesting things, I was rereading something you wrote in the Washington Post. I think it was right around the time we talked to you. And what was interesting to me is you said a landslide for Joe Biden resulted out of your war games thing there in a relatively orderly transfer of power. Every other scenario we looked at involved street level violence and political crisis. I would argue this was a landslide, 70 some electoral votes, same as Trump, who called it a landslide in 2016, 7 million votes. So that had to surprise you, did it not, that even in such a clear-cut victory, Trump did what Trump did?
So the way things, we looked at four scenarios, as you said, one of which was a Trump win, one was a long period of extended uncertainty, one was a narrow Biden win, and one was a decisive Biden win. And the way this actually played out was sort of fell somewhere in between our narrow and decisive Biden win scenario. Mm. Our decisive Biden win scenario had a greater electoral vote advantage. But I mean, I think what we're seeing is what we saw as, in some ways, the best case scenario. And it pains me to say that mobs taking over the U.S. Capitol, but not ultimately succeeding, is the best case scenario, but that's where we landed. I mean, I think our hope had been that by sounding those warning bells early on, that enough people would take enough actions to prevent things from ever getting this bad. And I think that the fact that we ended up where we are, you know, suggests deep collective failures of imagination, of political will, of courage.
But damage done nevertheless, even if they didn't get the outcome that they were desiring.
Absolutely.
Damage internally and damage in terms of our reputation. If I remember correctly, when we spoke, Rosa Brooks, first time, you were one of your Transition Integrity Project people, talked about how much of what governs, for lack of a better word, the time between election and inauguration are norms, not laws. And it seems to me, I don't have the solutions, but it seems to me that what we've seen already with 13 days to go in terms of this interim period suggests that a lot of things need to be changed. Larry Tribe, emeritus at Harvard Law School, and I were talking on TV the other night, and he was suggesting that maybe we have to talk about amending the Constitution in terms of pardon power during this period. Do you think we do need some law changes to how and what a president can do, or would it have no effect on a Trumpian kind of character?
No, it's a great question. I think that it's not that law isn't important. It's just that law doesn't exist in some realm outside of politics and culture. Law is mm-hmm. part of politics and culture. Law is effective when people care about it. You know, when they believe it matters, it matters. When people ignore it, if enough people start ignoring it, it stops mattering. And I think that if the political will exists in Congress to rein in executive power across a range of fronts, if the political will exists to make some of the needed reforms to our presidential election systems in Congress, and if we're talking about things that would require a constitutional amendment, then you'd need at the state legislative level as well. Right. You know, if there's the political will to change the laws, that is indicative of a powerful surge in concern about the underlying norms. I think if there's not enough political will to make any of those legal reforms, that tells us that we don't have a commitment to the underlying norms. And that's my fear, frankly, is that one of the things that I found even more stunning than the fact that an angry mob was able to waltz into the Capitol, you know, and cause destruction and terror within the Capitol, is the fact that after that occurred, we still had, you know, about almost, you know, 140, 150 Republican members of Congress who voted against certifying the electoral college votes for no reason, right? Trump has kind of flipped this. Normally, if you assert fraud, the burden is on those asserting fraud to offer some evidence, and right. They have somehow successfully, rhetorically flipped this as, you know, Biden has to prove there was no fraud, which is, of course, an impossibility. You know, you can never prove a negative. And if that's our norm going forward, then anyone who loses any election can say the winner has to prove that they didn't win through fraud. Otherwise, I refuse to accept the result. But the fact that so many Republican national elected officials were willing, even after that vivid display of mob violence and threat to the fabric of American democracy, were willing to vote against certifying the Electoral College votes in Arizona and Pennsylvania, doesn't bode very well for the future willingness of Congress as a body to support needed reforms.
Well, that's what I always wonder, and I guess you can't really game this out in your Transition Integrity Project, but I've always thought Trump was unhinged. I think more than ever he's unhinged. And this is when he was, you know, back in New York being a developer. So that is part of the problem here, is that you had someone, I hope he was unique, but maybe he's not, that had this ability, this cult-like ability to persuade people that blue is green and black is blue kind of thing. And that's where it does seem as our system does fall apart, if you have him getting millions of people to believe that, and then their elected representatives to go along with that so that they can get reelected. That's kind of a hole, a 18-wheeler size hole, I think, in what our founders, well, I guess they anticipated it somewhat, but not very much, right?
Well, I think, you know, I remember that old Monty Python skit about the Spanish Inquisition, where someone says, well, I wasn't expecting the Spanish Inquisition. And then the Spanish Inquisition bursts in saying, no one's ever expecting the Spanish Inquisition. No one ever expects the Spanish Inquisition. Sorry.
No, that's great.
That was a good one.
But it's true, right? So I spent a lot of my career studying and working in societies where the worst did happen. You know, civil wars, genocides, mass atrocities, and no one ever expects it. You know, in Bosnia, up to the collapse, everybody's saying, running around saying, oh no, but we have a multi-ethnic society, we all get along. You know, Rwanda, a year before the genocide, you people saying, oh no, inconceivable, we all get along. You know, that horrific events like earthquakes are inconceivable until they happen. And even the intellectual knowledge that there is some subterranean instability does not, you know, this is sort of human psychology, doesn't make us really believe that it could happen anytime. And we tend to think that because it didn't happen yesterday, it won't happen tomorrow. And statistically, there's some validity in that, you know, in terms of the odds, but we're not very good at thinking about probabilities. You know, bad things could always happen. And when bad things happen from a sort of political, cultural perspective, they often happen virtually overnight. It takes many, many years, decades, to build robust, strong, pro-democracy, pro-human rights cultures. But unfortunately, what history tells us is that atrocities and political conflict can erupt virtually overnight. It's easier to destroy, and faster to destroy than to build.
Talking to Rosa Brooks from Georgetown Law School, co-founder of the Transition Integrity Project. I know for the Transition Integrity Project, Rosa, you had a bunch of your colleagues and friends and all that sort of thing. Can we move on to the post-inaugural transition project that now, I guess, is a project of one, Rosa Brooks, for the moment? 70% of the people before yesterday, at least 70% of Republicans, believe the election was stolen from Donald Trump. He has a history of being pretty relentless in the pursuit of convincing people that a loss is a victory and all those sort of things. It's January 21st. And despite all the talk about mainstream news places like ours to say we're not going to do fawn over coverage of this ex-president, assuming he decides to stay in the game in some fashion and those 70% continue to believe that the election was stolen from their guy, what are the worst case scenarios there in your estimation?
Oh, I don't even want to go into worst case scenarios because the worst case scenarios are horrific. I guess this is what I was getting at a minute ago. Anyone who thinks it couldn't happen here is wrong. Every horrific thing that has ever happened anywhere could happen here. I hope it won't. It's our job collectively to make sure it doesn't, but it could. And I think unless we proceed on that premise, you know, that democracy doesn't sustain itself, that a culture of nonviolence and lawfulness does not sustain itself, that it takes hard work all the time from every single person to sustain it, then we increase the likelihood that things fall apart. And I think that, you know, recovering from this is going to be extraordinarily difficult. I think that even with the Democrats taking the Senate, which means that President-elect Joe Biden's legislative agenda has much more chance of being successful. Sure. Trump is, as you say, he's not likely to just disappear and be quiet. Literally, unless he ends up in jail, he's not likely to disappear or be quiet. And, you know, he's going to do his darndest to continue to whip up a frenzy in his supporters with continued false claims. And I think to me, the really important players will be people like the Mitch McConnells of the world, who belatedly, yesterday said, this is unacceptable. We have to respect the vote of the American people. There was no evidence of fraud that would change the outcome. Mm-hmm. That matters, but it was too late. You know, if Mitch McConnell had said that on November 7th, mm-hmm. It would have made a big difference, right? To have key political leaders, you know, there are people who will never care what anybody thinks, right? There will always be crazy people, but for that 70% of Republicans who believe that vote fraud cost President Trump his reelection, probably half of those people, at least, do care what Republican national leaders say, what statewide Republican leaders say. You know, they're not entirely lost to reason. And if those political leaders do not actively work to say, This was legitimate. You people need to stand down and stop these claims about falsehood. And I'm going to try to do everything in my power to stop these claims about falsehood from continuing to spread. You know, we need that to happen. Otherwise, things won't change. I don't think this is something that Joe Biden can do by himself. I don't think this is something the Democrats can do by mm-hmm. themselves. That we need Republicans with any vestige of sanity and souls need to be part of this, or it will fail.
Rosa, we look forward to your book. Thanks so much for calling in. Thanks for your time.
Always happy to come on and cheer you all up.
Thank you, Rosa. Bye-bye. Rosa Brooks, bye-bye. Rosa Brooks is a former Pentagon official in the Obama administration and the Scott K. Ginsburg Professor of Law and Policy at Georgetown Law. Her forthcoming book is Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. Up next, we're taking your calls. We'll take your calls at the top of the hour. We'll take them again a bunch of times during the show today. We're talking, of course, about the storming of the Capitol yesterday. Our number is 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. You are listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For months, we've been bracing for the violence that we thought Trump would unleash in the country if he lost the election. But did it fail to prepare us for the reality of yesterday's violence, to see images of the Confederate flag flying high in the halls of Congress, congressional leaders ducking for cover in House and Senate chambers, men and women hanging from the balconies of the Capitol, men clad in MAGA hats, taking over Speaker Pelosi's office. We're taking your calls. As Marjorie said, we'll take them a lot throughout the rest of the show. We'll have a guest or two with us, but mostly your calls on yesterday's day of infamy and what you think is the impact of that going forward. 877-301-8970. We're going to talk to Andrew Kerbal a little bit about the performance of law enforcement people yesterday as well.
You know, I was listening to my favorite podcast, The Daily, this morning, had reporters that were there in the Capitol as this was going on. Yeah. It was really frightening. Our own Jim McGovern apparently was up there presiding at the beginning when they got this warning that the Capitol had been breached. And this one reporter was talking about how the Capitol Police came in and rushed the senators and later House members out of there, and were so panicked that they picked up Mitch McConnell in his armpits. I guess Mitch McConnell, I did not know this, had polio, and maybe he can't walk as fast as somebody else. But picked him up under his armpits to rush him down to this secluded spot. And we're going to talk with Congressman Bill Keating later in the show about this as well. And, you know, they had Schumer by the back of his neck to make sure he got down there in time. And people, you could hear these, they talked about being under, they were told to take out gas masks from under their seats, and how you could hear the whirring sound of the gas masks. And people hiding behind chairs. I mean, I think that there was a real fear. You can imagine. And then they could hear gunshots. We know that a woman was killed by Capitol Police.
Three other people died, too.
And from medical issues. But I think it was four other people, was it? Was it four all
told? Four altogether, I think. Whatever it was. I mean, a lot of people died in the Capitol.
In any case, it was a really frightening scene. So just something you don't expect, as we've said a million times, to see in the United States of America. Number is 877-301-8970. Raven from East End, thank you for calling.
Hey, Raven.
Yeah, guys, how are you doing?
Great.
Well, I would say never better, but that's not true.
Well,
so
here's the deal, though. To your point, Jim, what I think is really true is Mitch McConnell and all the Republicans, they didn't announce, they didn't concede to the fact that there was no fraud, that these were just allegations, that there was nothing concrete that they could submit, and even that their claims of fraud in the courts was dismissed because they didn't really allege fraud because they were worried about being disbarred, the legal team. That was a threat to them. But anyway, the point I want to make is I think they waited so long until this storming of the Capitol because they wanted to see how it would play out for them. Here's some allegations of fraud. We haven't lost the presidency. We're whipping up our supporters. And let's not forget that every single moment more money comes in. And we heard the stories about who was that millionaire who wanted his money back because he thought it was going to go to fight the courts. And he found out it was just paying off the legal debt. Mm-hmm. There was a huge moment, you know, and people don't remember. But another thing I wanted to say before I go, and I want to hear what you guys have to say and shut me up. But here's the deal. To quote Mr. Biden, here's the deal, is that if you traveled before COVID, did you guys go to any airports? Did you do any traveling? If you did, you saw in the gift shops, those Hudson News gift shops or whatever it was, they have these militarized Trump T-shirts everywhere. This has been going on for years. Mm-hmm. He's standing on a tank.
Well, you know,
he's the White Knight.
Yeah, Raven, and also thank you for your call. We're going to discuss law enforcement and their unpreparedness or unwillingness or something yesterday. But talk about those gift shops. I went online, and I'm not on that part of the internet that a lot of these rioters were. And you saw photographs of these people and the weapons they were planning on bringing to Washington. I mean, this...
Well, some of them had weapons, obviously.
Should have... I know. I'm just saying. People in positions of law enforcement should have known this was coming. And maybe they did, and maybe they didn't give a damn. I don't know. Colby and Middleborough, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Colby.
Hey, how's it going, guys? How are you?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
Good. Good. I was just wondering, I'd see a lot going on as far as verbiage goes with what happened earlier this year when they took over Seattle and turned it into Chaz or whatever they did versus what happened yesterday with people taking over the State House. It's all crazy to me, you know, the extremists are crazy on both sides.
Well, you know, once again, I hear you, Colby, but this equivalency notion, and actually one or two people did die in that unpoliced area, but, you know, respectfully, Colby, comparing what those demonstrators did out there and comparing with an effort to storm our seat of government in Washington, to me, ain't even close. But Colby, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970.
Well, it wasn't close. I mean, lots of us went to Black Lives Matter protests. People were wearing masks at those protests. They were handing out masks. If you didn't have them, they were handing out hand sanitizers. People weren't... This was like a... When you saw the people coming in the Capitol, it was just a totally different thing. But I want to mention the whole thing with the guns.
But there was violence in that Seattle thing. It's just...
Yes, there was. Okay. But it's also Seattle is different, I think, than the capital of the United States of America. But that red state secession thing that was banned by Facebook, that was another place. They were always calling for these violent protests, and they would, you know, had lists... addresses of federal judges and members of Congress and progressive politicians with all these pictures of guns and everything. So there's this whole, wasn't Rudy Giuliani talking about battling to the end for the rights of Donald Trump? I mean, there's all this.
He made the rally yesterday. He did.
Yeah, there's all this gun stuff all over the place.
Linda North Attleboro. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. I was so basically yesterday when I was watching everything, I was I was a little annoyed in a sense because, you know, during the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, there was a lot of people out there for a real reason, which was for, you know, criminal, for police brutality.
Right.
They just want the system to change to be equal for everyone. And with this protest, or I'm not even going to call it a protest, to be honest, they were fighting for something that was false, that was made up. And some people are trying to equate both of them, which is you can't, because one group, Black Lives Matter, is fighting for something that is happening every day to a lot of Americans. And this is they're fighting over something that was false. And
great point.
I completely blame the Republican Party. Even if people didn't jump on the train, the Trump train, because of their silence, this is what happened. And the populist movement, if they look back at history, it wasn't as successful as in American history. So I don't understand how they can equate both of them. And at the same time, how was there not enough police presence at the Capitol? Because during all the protests in the summer, you saw National Guards, you saw police pushing back protesters. Sometimes the protesters didn't have to do anything, and they just got tear gassed, or they got hit with rubber bullets.
Well, you know, Linda, by the way, we're going to discuss that with Andrew Cabral. You know that the reports are that the person who finally called out the National Guard was not the President of the United States, but the Vice President of the United States, who arguably doesn't even have the power to do it. So, Linda, you make a lot of great thoughts. You know, when she mentions the Black Lives Matter demonstrators, let me be the 3,000th person to say that. Make the point that if those had been black rioters yesterday or black protesters yesterday, it would have been. There's a great tweet this morning from a black activist, and I can't remember his name. He says, I'm not arguing that the cops yesterday should have shot them like they shoot us. I am arguing that just like they don't shoot them, they shouldn't shoot us. And I thought that was just a wonderful point. But again, had this been thousands and thousands of black people storming the Capitol, if anybody thinks the results would have been anything like they were yesterday, you're a fool.
And
just go Roger and Marblehead.
Just coming up, we'll talk with Andrew about why that took so long to get there.
Yep.
By the way,
Roger, hi.
For the reinforcements.
Hi. Good morning,
hi, Roger.
Guys. I spoke to you yesterday, saying that I thought the sergeant of arms should arrest these people when they.
Oh, you're that Roger. Yeah.
But I think today, after watching the obviously outrageous actions yesterday, that the idea of a coup now appeals to me. And I think what Biden ought to do is call the Joint Chiefs, call Pelosi, call McConnell, call the cabinet, and just come to a soft coup arrangement that says, look, Trump is not going to be in charge for the next, 2 weeks. We just sideline him. We understand this is extra, constitutional. But for the good of the country, for the fact that this nut job still has the nuclear codes, we're simply going to sideline him because there's not time to impeach him or invoke the 25th Amendment, which, of course, I would heartily support. But it's probably not going to happen. And there needs to be common sense governance of the country to avoid what could easily be a lot worse than what happened yesterday.
Roger, can I correct one thing that you said? There is plenty of time to invoke the 25th Amendment.
Well,
there is not enough time to impeach and remove this president, even if the Republicans were willing to take that vote. There is plenty of time for the vice president and a majority of the members of Donald Trump's cabinet to invoke that and have him removed. I'm not saying it's likely, but it's essentially a constitutional, I guess Trump would call it a coup, but a constitutional removal that, and by the way, Bill Keating is among the people who supports that move. He's going to join us at 1 o'clock, so we'll hear what he has to say. Roger, again, thank you for a call and your thoughts. Is this unbelievable, by the way, this happened yesterday? It's one of these things where so many incredible things happen, but this is really at a different level than the sickness that
said
Trump
is. President Trump talked about American carnage in his inaugural address, and
that's right.
People saying it's bookends.
Right.
American carnage was yesterday. We're going to be opening up the lines several more times during the show if you have want to call. But right now, right after the news, we're going to talk with Andrea Cabral for her take on Trump encouraging chaos and sparking one of the worst security breaches in our history, and what took the police so long to react. Andrea Cabral is up for a segment of Law and Order. What better day to discuss Law and Order than this one? You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Out of the thousands of pro-Trump rioters who sieged the Capitol building Wednesday, only about a dozen have been arrested. Men were photographed sitting at Speaker Pelosi's desk, destroying nameplates, looting the building, as Capitol Police were unprepared and overrun by the sheer number of agitators attempting to enter the building. They also oversaw the orderly exit of a number of them and let them walk free. Andrew Cabral will join us in a couple of minutes to discuss the law enforcement operations and security failures on Wednesday.
Urged on by President Trump's rhetoric during a rally on Wednesday, thousands stormed the Capitol building, interrupting Congress and forcing lawmakers to shelter in place. Most members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation are now urging the invocation of the 25th Amendment and the removal of President Trump after what transpired in the Capitol. Those include Congressman Bill Keating, who will join us to discuss his experience, that and more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So as an angry mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol, clashed with police, Trump tweeted the following: "We are the party of law and order." Yesterday, the president and his GOP loyalists made a mockery of law and order by encouraging violence and utterly failing to lock off the city and protect its people and members of Congress. Joining us on the line to talk about a display of lawlessness and disorder is Andrea Cabral. Andrea is the former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety, and she is now the CEO of Ascend. Hello, Andrea Cabral.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hey there.
So, Andrew Cabral, before we get to the police reaction or their slow reaction or why they didn't act faster here, I just wonder what your reaction was to this whole scenario yesterday.
Well, my reaction is that I always thought, I always knew he was capable of this, and I always thought that if his back was up against the wall, he would not just incite violence, which he's been doing since, 2017, actually before that, but he was doing it mostly within his own rallies aimed at hecklers, but that he would actually, decide that it was time to execute it. And there's just no doubt in my mind that he had a sense of what they would be doing when he told them that they were going to head to the Capitol and that he would be with them. There's just no question in my mind that this was an insurrection incited by him, especially once I think Pence told him that he would not seek to overturn by any means the results of the election. That was sort of his last great hope. So,
how far have we fallen, Andrew Cabral, that when a vice president says to the president, I'm not going to participate in an insurrection, and I'm actually going to follow the Constitution, that he gets celebrated throughout the land? I mean, is that unbelievable?
Yeah, I don't even know that that a bar even exists for us to crawl under at this point. That people are getting credit for doing not just what is right, but what is constitutional, what they swore an oath to do, and only doing the bare minimum under that standard. The entire thing is pretty sad. But, the thing that I can't get over is that it's been so obvious from the very beginning. And I realize it's what might be obvious to me might not be obvious to other people. But, he had a lot of help getting to this point, not calling lies lies right from the beginning when they were clearly lies, accepting the smashing of norms, everything from simple things, not turning over medical records, not releasing his taxes, to clearly profiting time and time again from the presidency financially, the levels of corruption in his own cabinet, Secretary Act. How many people has he gone through in his cabinet, not just cabinet secretaries, but others, that have gone by the wayside either because they refused to do things that he wanted them to do that were clearly unconstitutional, or they were corrupt and were literally driven from office. It's not even a trail of breadcrumbs. It's just a bright red line from January 20th of 2017 to yesterday. And the failure to follow that line is a big part, but the failure on the part of lots of different systems and groups, not least of which is the GOP in Congress and Republicans generally, is how we got there to where we are right now. It's just really clear to me.
Talking to Andrew Cabral. Speaking of failure, what happened yesterday? Were they just unprepared? Were they unwilling? What happened to security at the Capitol and around the Capitol?
Well, if we're smart, there will be sort of the 9/11 type commission whose members are beyond reproach, who really delve into this and really, look at it in an unvarnished way and do an investigation. But I think it's probably a combination of things. I think very hard to watch that footage of, you read all the initial reports that they stormed barricades, which I think they did at certain parts of the Capitol, but it's hard to look at that footage where they are literally let in. And there are at least three Capitol police that appear to be letting them mm-hmm. get access to the Capitol. So I think that there's that. And I think that harkens back to, a report that's over 10 years old now about the level of infiltration in police departments and law enforcement of, Proud Boy types, white supremacist mm-hmm. types. And I think that's a whole investigation in and of itself. But I also think that there was a level of complacency. It just makes no sense to me. None of this makes any sense to me. I think about
When I was Secretary of Public Safety, no matter what the potential incident was, especially if you were coordinating with federal law enforcement, there's always a level of intelligence there that you are relying on. First of all, there are always informants. Let's just not kid ourselves that there's something like a perfect conspiracy or a perfect plan that no one ever picks up the phone and calls any law enforcement person to disclose. And I'm wondering where the intelligence is. Even if you don't have informants, I'm wondering where the scouring of social... They organize this through social media.
Yeah.
By the way,
by
I knew about... I knew
social.
This. I said before, Andrea, I was on social media and not the places where they have the ability and knowledge to go, but just superficial taking a look at it. And I knew what the potential for yesterday was.
But you know... But, you know, you also saw, Andrea, pictures when they have that perimeter fence around the Capitol. I mean, it's not really a hard fence to knock over. But you saw, like, 30 people and two cops, like 30 people on one side and two cops on the other side trying to prevent them from knocking over the fence. And, of course, they completely overran the cops. And so it seemed like it was, like, both – there were – also, police officers took selfies with some of these protesters. I mean, that was all over the internet yesterday, too. But it seemed to me it was two things. You know, it was maybe, you know, what you talked about, too, that the people, that some of these police officers were on the side of the protesters, and also that they were just totally overrun. You saw these guys running into the Capitol and police officers, you know, one cop kind of backing up away from them. I thought, wow.
But being overrun, Marjorie, is a product of not being prepared for the obvious. You make sure you have backup people,
absolutely.
That you have adequate resources.
I guess that's what I think you're wondering when you're watching this on television. Where are the D.C. cops? Where is the National Guard? Where is the, I guess the FBI did come in later, their assault, you know, attack squad or something. But you're thinking, where's
the cops?
But that's
my point about, this is Washington, D.C.
Right.
This is a place where protests, peaceful ones anyway, are celebrated as an expression of the First Amendment. I was at the Million Woman March after Trump was inaugurated. And it really was, I think it was over a million people. And we marched all the way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. There was not a single violent incident. And they were prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
They were prepared for that to happen. It didn't happen, but it was a regular protest. The idea that you could know that you're dealing with Trump supporters in particular, who he's been churning up and feeding into their grievances and telling them that anything they do in defense of him in particular is justified, and then he shows them how he pardons people who help him out.
Right.
Offers to pay legal fees and bail for people who beat up hecklers in his rallies. You know who you're dealing with.
Yeah.
So that's what makes this particularly disturbing is that, and even the New York Times, I think, had a report about, it wasn't the entire story, but a portion of the story was about how federal agencies had, you know, had been meeting and the D.C. police were involved and, you know, all in preparation of this because he had been crowing about the fact that it was going to happen, I think, for, you know, about a month, you know, come to D.C. on January 6th, it's going to be wild.
Wild.
Tweeting stuff like this. So that's what I think, you know, goes really to the heart of this, is how on that day this could have developed the way it did and, you know, everybody have been so vulnerable. I mean, keep in mind, he sent that crowd to a building where he knew his vice president was. Just put aside for a second all of the people in Congress. We know he doesn't care about any of them.
That's a very good point.
But he sent them to a place that he knew the vice president was after the vice president told him, can't help you.
Mm. Well, you know, you can't help thinking, Andrea, that there's never been more of a sycophant than Mike Pence. I mean, watching him like staring at the president like he's Nancy Reagan staring at Ronald Reagan for 4 years. And now the guy finally doesn't do what the president wants him to do. And, you know, some of the Trump people want, you know, poor Mike Pence taken out and shot at dawn for not doing the president's bidding. And apparently the president was fuming all night long and day long about Pence. So I guess all that sucking up didn't do him any good.
No,
or Bill Barr or anybody else. What?
I don't know.
How do you not know that? There is every this happens every single time.
Yeah.
He's good with you until he's not, and he's not when you say no. So for Pence to be surprised by any of this, or to not, as the vice president of the country, not be able to see where this leads or why it would be a bad thing to follow someone who, A, does the things that Trump does, but more importantly, shows, in Pence's terms, shows you no loyalty no matter how much you've done. Look what he did to Bill Barr. Pence had the most recent example right in front of him, which was Bill Barr. What did he think was going to happen? And the fact that he's saying, you know, after all I did for this guy, just shows you, I just don't know what's wrong with any of these people, but I do know that they're unfit to lead.
You know, Andrea, by the way, speaking of unfit to lead, Chuck Schumer, the soon-to-be leader of the Democratic leader of the Senate, announced in the last 20 minutes that he supports a removal of the president immediately under the 25th Amendment as...
Yeah, well, don't let us hurry you or anything.
Yeah. Well, actually, did you, am I right? You just reminded me of something. You said, don't let it hurry. You were of the opinion, I believe I'm right about this, that Pelosi has a, I don't know if it's a moral obligation, some sort of an obligation to immediately initiate impeachment proceedings. Is that you?
Oh, I've been saying that. I've been saying that from, you know, for the last 4 years that, you know, well, certainly after the midterms, once the midterms were done and the Democrats had a majority in the House, I was saying you need to start impeachment proceedings now and you need to keep impeaching him. Different sets of articles of impeachment. I don't care whether or not the Senate denies you a trial. Those sets of articles of impeachment, the country will know, and they will be sitting on the Senate president's desk because he was always going to do this if he lost. And because you need to hold, you have a unique power. If you're in the House, the House has a singular and unique power to hold a rogue president, an unfit president, accountable. And the failure to do that under these circumstances with this president until you're backed into a corner by a whistleblower disclosing the Ukraine call, and then the failure to repeat doing it as more and more comes out and his behavior, as Adam Schiff said, doesn't abate. That was, to me, that's just a very huge and singular failure. And I know that there's sort of this intrinsic reluctance to institutional reluctance to declare that the country has made such a big mistake. But this is the price of not doing that. And now people are biting their nails in these last few days because he's, you know, now they're really afraid. Now that these people have gone into the Capitol and it is,
it's them.
Legislators cowering right under desks and calling home and telling their relatives goodbye. Now it seems to them to be really real. But to the kids who were kidnapped from their parents, who are being physically and sexually abused, the kids of undocumented immigrants in these prisons we've been keeping them in now for years, that's the fear they have always felt. So that's the other element of this, is until it happens to me, maybe I can't really understand how dangerous this guy is, and I think that probably infuriates me most of all. To the people that have been shot and killed repeatedly by police officers, usually unarmed black people, that's the fear that all black people feel all the time. So, you know, I'm just angered by the idea that people are now saying, oh, my goodness, maybe we should look at the 25th Amendment and maybe we should impeach him again. What? Who were you watching all this time? Who did you have in front of you that you thought that before now, before he set a mob on the Capitol, it was somehow unjustified to remove him from office? It's insane.
You mentioned shooting of black people. We do, before you go in a minute, want to talk about the decision not to prosecute the cop who shot Jacob Blake in the back 7 times out there in Kenosha, because it shouldn't get lost in all of this stuff. But I want to stay on Pence for one more minute. I know it's conjecture, but what do you make of the reports that haven't been contradicted that it was Pence who ultimately decided that the National Guard should be called out, which he has no power? I mean, it sort of reminds you of Alexander Haig, and I'm in charge here, when after Reagan was shot when he had no formal power to be in charge there. He allegedly was the one who made the decision to call out the National Guard. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it first speaks to probably a deep-seated but long-suppressed knowledge on the part of Pence just how unfit the president is and just how out of control the president is. Because he also, you know, to Marjorie's point, and he did look adoringly at the president every single time in a very sort of creepy way, he was not one to buck the trend. He's also reported as being the one who was least likely to draw the president's ire at any given time. You know, the president's verbally abusive to everyone. Pence was usually spared that. So the fact that he called in the National Guard, it makes it very clear that he understood the gravity of the situation and he was facing a president who didn't want the Capitol to be protected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, Trump resisted all that. He didn't want to call in the National Guard. This is also an argument, by the way, for D.C.'s statehood, because if D.C. was a state, it would have a governor, and that governor would be able to deploy the National Guard. There are lots of reasons for D.C. to be a state, but this is a classic example of a territory being under siege but being faced with the refusal by the president and the recalcitrance by the lackeys that he has installed at the last minute at places like, you know, Department of Defense and DNI and DOJ to actually act on behalf of the health and safety of the people who work and live in the Capitol.
You know,
I think Pence looked at it and said, somebody has to do something because he's not going to, and this is going to get much worse.
You know, Andrea Carvell, before we move to Jacob Blake, we had E.J. Dion from the Washington Post with us at 11 o'clock. And one of the last things we asked him is what worried him or what caused the most fear in him if Donald Trump does serve out his final 13 days. What's your answer to that?
Oh, they're literally, people shouldn't kid themselves. There's literally nothing he's incapable of doing.
Like what?
Oh, he could. He easy to start a war. Easy to attempt to use nukes somewhere. Think of the thing that will create the greatest sort of destruction or chaos, and in the moment make him believe. You know, will salve his desire for revenge. That only happens, you know, momentarily. That's why he has to keep doing it over and over again. But I don't know why anybody would think that there is a bottom. He has never shown the country that there's a bottom. And to think otherwise is, again, we've been whistling past the graveyard on him since before he actually came down that escalator and announced his second run or, you know, for president, the first one he kind of backed out of. But I think it's a legitimate fear, and people need to take it very, very seriously. Why do you think he weaponized all of his followers?
Well, why?
They're cannon fodder. They're something for him to throw at keeping himself in the headlines, keeping his power intact, protecting his interests. You know, they're the pawns on a chessboard. They may not realize that, but there's a reason that he's done all of this. There's always a method here.
We're talking to Andrea Carvell. I've mentioned a couple times Jacob Blake, again, the local prosecutor in Kenosha, decided, not unlike, I guess, Daniel Cameron down there in Kentucky in the Breonna Taylor case, not to charge the white officer who shot the African-American Jacob Blake in the back seven times. I mean, I almost feel like a fool asking this question. What'd you make of that?
Well, what do you think I'm going to say, Jim?
Well, that's why I said I feel like, well, I should let me revisit that. I don't almost feel like a fool. I do feel like a fool, but I'm going to ask anyway. I mean, this racial reckoning that we are theoretically having in this country, I'm missing it for the most part.
There's certainly a great deal of effort to push the country toward racial reckoning, you know, we've been better at it at certain times than others, but the fact that we're still talking about it in 2020, how many reckonings have we had? None of them, however effective they might be in the moment, or however we tell ourselves they are in the moment, they don't stick. This is a central issue and problem that was actually brought into very stark relief yesterday when you saw the difference between literal insurrectionists and rioters looting the Capitol, threatening elected officials in the Capitol and how they were treated by the police versus Black Lives Matter protesters and other social justice activists who we've seen them kettled, unable to go home when the curfew struck because they were being, you know, sort of surrounded by police, beaten, gassed, you know, the whole thing. There are two systems of justice in this country, and there is a special tier of that that is reserved for police officers. You know, there are lots of people that do incredibly dangerous jobs. Nurses do in emergency rooms in particular, do incredibly dangerous jobs.
Yes.
Armed with nothing. And deal with people who are violent, who are contagious and violent, who are psychotic. You know, EMTs deal with all of this as well, and they are not armed. So don't tell me that because someone is holding a knife and you've got the back of their shirt, that you can't make any sort of evasive action. You can't pull them by their shirt, you know, thrust them back behind you, where you've then got something of an advantage, that your only alternative is to shoot that person, not even once or twice, which would be bad enough, but seven times in the back and paralyze them. And I will also say that a police officer's fear for their life has to be reasonable in the circumstances. I may fear for my life if it is just me and one other person who is armed with a knife, and maybe all I have is my gun. If I am surrounded by my colleagues and that person is attempting to get into a car and they're saying that he said that he had a knife in his hand, you're supposed to be trained to take all of that into consideration and act in a way that protects life and safety first. Yours, your colleagues, but also the person that you're dealing with. And there's a big difference between him being able to get in that car. If the fear was he's going to kidnap a child, that is not necessarily a fear for that child's life. But if he's going to get in the car and kidnap that child, you have more time to sort of deal with that. But just in terms of disarming him, why is it the only way you disarm somebody is to shoot them seven times in the back?
Andrea, last thing from me. Can a Biden-Harris Attorney General Merrick Garland team change this dynamic or no?
They can. A lot of it, Obama had made some very, very good progress in, you know, bringing the DOJ or building on the DOJ's, you know, mission around all of the civil rights stuff. And I think having Vanita Gupta go back and rejoin the DOJ, she was the head of the Civil Rights Division under Obama, is a great thing. But the problem is that it's you end up being you go two steps forward, three steps back, right? So first you have to undo all of the things, including this latest discriminatory thing of, you know, retracting the DOJ's, this new policy that they're putting into, well, they're retracting a policy of how discrimination and prejudice is measured. So you have to undo all of the bad stuff, and then you have to sort of, you know, reset the clock. It's the constant resetting of the clock that I think is the most troubling. But
Andrea,
I think they can do it, and I look forward to that.
Andrea, it's good to talk to you.
You too.
Be well.
Thanks, Andrea.
Bye.
Andrea Cabral joins us every week for Law & Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. Now she is the CEO of Ascend. Coming up, we continue our conversation about yesterday's storming of the Capitol. We're opening the call line, 877-301-8970. If you'd like to call in, that's our number. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org. You are listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. Well, it's your turn again at 877-301-8970. We're taking your calls, asking you about the violence incited by Trump. Left four people dead, a lot of fear in the Capitol, and a pretty bad image of the beacon of democracy throughout the world. 877-301-8970. You know, Marjorie, I because you were obsessed with right-wing media, I thought I'd bring you the bad news, and I think the good news, comparatively speaking, from Fox News. Here's Sean Hannity on his radio show yesterday floating a conspiracy that Trump supporters were there peacefully and that, of course, it was Antifa that was the problem.
Right.
Here's Hannity.
They were descending onto the town, and there they go. They're there to peacefully protest. And we had the reports that groups like Antifa, other radical groups, I don't know the names of all of them, that they were there to cause trouble.
Now, that shouldn't surprise you, but here is a lightly edited version of what Fox News' Brian Kilmeade had to say about the president's conduct since the election. This obviously is on the morning show Fox and Friends.
I mean, let's be honest. Since November 3rd, when we got the verdict by November 5th, the president's behavior has been terrible. When you lost Lindsey Graham, who has stood by him, talked to the president, understood him the best possible, when you lose all these people, when Tom Cotton says it's time for you to concede, I think that you've gone over the top. And I think when the president made those remarks, he couldn't even use his own Twitter account. He had to use Dan Scavino's because he's been justifiably suspended for the last 24 hours.
Justifiably suspended.
Wow.
That make you feel a little bit better?
Wow. Fox and Friends really does something. Well, in defense of Fox, I mean, I said this before, they're much better during the day. It's the nighttime. It's Tucker Carlson. It's Hannity. It's Laura Ingraham. And that's where they get their big ratings are at night.
Well, but Fox and Friends is the show that Donald Trump is called into about a million times.
He's
so they're
not
exactly
himself.
Critics historically of
no, they
the
have
president.
Not been critics historically. They have been part of this whole fog screen or fog, whatever you want to call it, that's descended all over the country. We were talking before we went on the air about one of the president's lawyers that's gone into court to argue about elections.
Lynn Wood,
Lynn Wood. I mean, this is how, and he's got a million followers.
Yep.
On Twitter, I assume. You know, he's mad at Pence, of course, now. He called him a traitor, communist sympathizer, a child
communist
molester.
Communist sympathizer?
Communist sympathizer, a child molester, and he should be locked up. Before that, he said he should face execution by firing squad.
I read that.
These are the lawyers that and that crazy Sidney Powell and the other woman that was next to the president when he was calling.
Cleta Mitchell, is that her name?
Whatever her name is, that was next to him when he was calling the people in Georgia to say, I need 11,000 votes. Can you find me 11,000 votes? Basically, I think she'd been fired by her law firm. I mean, she's resigned, but I think that they probably pushed her out the door because they were mortified that an attorney who's supposed to be a member of the bar and all that, Jim, was consorting with the president in this crazy endeavor to hardball the people in Georgia into breaking the law.
Speaking of Lynn Wood, I said the other day, he's the one who's responsible, I believe, for the comment that Chief Justice Roberts was in league with Jeffrey Epstein, that he was a pedophile, and that he was involved, in the assassination of Antonin Scalia. These are Trump's These are Trump's lawyers.
I mean, you laugh, but you know,
I'm not
you
laughing.
Think,
you are.
I'm laughing because it seems so. Like I've said a million times, it's like the National Enquirer, and it used to be at the checkout when we used to have the National Enquirer at the checkout when it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and they were talking about babies with two heads and you know landing on Pluto and all these crazy things. I mean, that guy, that Nashville guy, you know, he was talking about lizard people. The guy that blew up that van downtown, downtown, and it used to say, wow, that's really probably someone has some problems in their lives and they've kind of lost sight of reality. But it's not just a few people anymore, apparently.
Yeah, but I'll say what I've said a lot. I know people are tired of this, so I'll say it quickly. In my opinion, since I'm not inhibited by the Goldwater rule that the American Psychology Association puts out, Donald Trump is seriously mentally ill. I don't have the training to diagnose him. I have the common sense to diagnose him, and everything that everybody talks about and how to rein in a Donald Trumpian kind of figure who's the president of the United States, all of it ignores the fact that I think the clearest evidence is not just that he's a megalomaniac, not just that he can't ever accept defeat, but we have a president, in my estimation, who is seriously mentally ill, not just unhinged, as you've said, for years and years and years, and we have no idea how to deal with that, and it's a dangerous proposition.
Okay, one last thing, and I'll shut up and get to the calls. But that's not the only problem. The problem is you have people around him who put up with this kind of stuff.
I think the people you described are exactly like him.
I don't think Corey Lewandowski's mentally ill.
Oh, no, I don't.
Do you think
Corey
Lewandowski's from New Hampshire. You know, he's had a few incidents, I guess, with his neighbors and, you know, that we don't want to get into necessarily. But,
it's good you didn't bring it up then.
When I asked him a couple of times on the radio, I don't think you were there that day, about
listening.
QAnon. You're going to disavow QAnon? And basically, he's not going to disavow QAnon. And QAnon is the one that thinks everybody's a pedophile. You know, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, they're all pedophiles. They got this sex ring going on in the basement. He won't. And we have a QAnon person elected to Congress.
Yep.
I think we have several people
from Georgia
in Congress now who go along with these crazy theories. So I think that's the problem. I guess if someone is mentally ill, well, they're mentally ill. But
fish rots from the head.
When the non-mentally ill people are thinking that, you can think a lot of things about Hillary Clinton, but I don't think she's running a sex ring in the basement of a pizza joint in Washington, D.C.
Let's go to Mark in Pawtucket. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Mark. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
I'm a long-time listener and a frequent caller.
Thank you.
I just want to say, especially after listening to Andrea, my stepson and son, who are both black, almost immediately said yesterday that had the mob been predominantly people of color, the outcome would have been very different.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Almost with a resignation, almost like with a chuckle, like that's what they would have done, you know. And it's just such a sad commentary. We've talked often about, you know, what happens, you know, even I worry all the time when they go out, you know, and we, you know, it's kind of sad that you have to tell them to make sure to be polite if you're pulled over and blah, 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 all kinds of rules and, you know, recommendations. And just that, you know, I guess I'm calling to say that the sad fact is that had that mob been, you know, made up of different people, the outcome would have been very different.
I think the kids you're talking about nailed it, unfortunately, Mark. And thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Let's not forget that Joe Biden said the reason he decided to get back into the race was he watched Charlottesville on
That's
television.
Right.
People remember that was that march at the University of Virginia when people were shouting, "Jews will not replace us," and all this racist
Heather
stuff.
Heather Heyer was killed.
Yes, Heather Heyer was killed, and the president's reaction to that was there were nice people on both sides. So that was early in his presidency, and that didn't cause outrage among many of his fellow Republicans at all. Phil and Newton, thank you for calling.
Hi, Phil.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is my first time calling in. You guys are rock stars in my book.
Thank you.
I'm calling because yesterday, obviously, it was just so utterly disgusting and sad. But I was in limbo considering what would have happened if Congress was unable to reconvene on January 6th to certify the electoral votes, if that could have led to a contingent election where the House selected the president and then the Republican-led Senate gets to select the vice president.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I was doing a little research last night as to whether or not they constitutionally had to do what they ultimately did at 3:30 in the morning on January 6th. And it appears they did. And as soon as I realized they were coming back into session at 8 o'clock, I stopped researching. So is that fantasy thinking or fantasy fear on your part, or do you know something, Phil, that we don't about what might have happened?
So I don't. So this is why I'm calling, because I was hoping maybe you could shed some light if it could have led to a constitutional crisis where, I mean, they didn't actually certify the votes on January 6th, which is by law they have to. So obviously, we can't go back. They've already certified it. But yeah, it was sort of a fantasy thinking, but also a really scary thought.
Well, there were a lot of scary thoughts. We'll actually have one of our colleagues check it out. I don't know what the answer is, but I'm guessing that some of the legal experts on TV might have broached it had it been a possibility. But we'll check. Phil, thank you for listening, and thank you for calling. We appreciate it.
You know, there was a great little detail in the stories.
To
tell you, there was a great little detail in one of the stories about how when they were all being evacuated, the Congress people, that somebody thought to snatch the container contained with the Electoral College certificates.
Those two women staff people,
that's right. The people might have infiltrated the, where the Congress sits or where the Senate sits and taken them.
Or destroyed them. What would happen then? I assume that would, I mean, getting back to Phil's call a minute ago, if you don't have them to count, I assume you got to re-ask for them from the whatever the state authorities are. That might have been a problem, too. I don't know what the solution would have been there either. There's a photograph of these two women staffers, one each holding the side of this beautiful wooden box in which the certifications or whatever, I don't know if it's proper nomenclature, the certifications of all the state's electors sat. So that could have been a problem, too. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Lincoln, and Sam's there. Hi, Sam.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I think we're facing a moment when we've got to put aside our inclination to just resort to denial. And I think this is a moment not unlike in the late 30s when we were facing the prospect of a fascist Hitler taking over Europe. And this is the Neville Chamberlain moment. You can't appease these people. There's no possibility of appeasement. You know, I called your show a couple of days ago. I didn't get on, but I wanted to make the point that the Justice Department under Biden has to investigate Trump for possible crimes after trying to strong-arm Raffensperger into overturning the election. And 2 days later, I'm calling again to say it's more serious than that. The 25th Amendment has to be invoked. The House has to drop articles of impeachment, and we can't turn away from this moment. We're faced with an enemy, and you can't turn away from it and hope that it will go away and we don't want to rile things up anymore. We have to face this moment, and this is what is required.
Sam, can I respond to part of that? First of all, Bill Keating, congressman from Massachusetts, is going to join us in 15 minutes, who agrees with you on the 25th Amendment. And he'll speak to that. You know, we had E.J. Dionne on the top of the show. Marjorie asked him about the prosecution of Trump, not so much by the state or city of New York, because obviously that's independent. Joe Biden doesn't, or the Justice Department doesn't control it. And he said, I had mixed feelings, but I ultimately come down, I think, where you are. And so do I. I mean, the problem is, even though I agree it will further divide the country, even though I agree it will put Trump's back center stage, which is exactly where he wants to be, if you have a memo that says you can't prosecute, you can investigate, not prosecute, a sitting president who has committed what it seems to me are an endless succession of constitutional and criminal law violations, and there's no sanction when he leaves office, then you're basically saying that any president can violate the law and the Constitution with impunity. So it took me a while, but I am exactly where you are, Sam, is nobody should be above the law, and it doesn't matter whether he or she is the president or not. So I end up where you do, and thanks so much for your thoughts. Where are you on that, Marjorie, about prosecuting a post-presidency Trump?
Well, I get why Biden doesn't want to do it, but I think when you are this lawless and this reckless, to let him just retreat to Mar-a-Lago, well, I guess he can't go to Mar-a-Lago, they don't want him there or whatever, but wherever he ends up going, I think it's bad. I think it's bad to let him get away with this. I really do. I think the New York prosecutors are going to go after his finances. But it's more than that. It's you know, people are emailing asking, can the mayor of Washington indict him for inciting violence or arrest him for inciting violence? I don't think she can. But there's a sense that when you do these kinds of things and you get away with it, it just undermines people's belief that we're a nation of laws and not of men, as we said back in the Nixon days. But listen to this. We had a couple of good emails to share. This is from Deb in Rockport. She said, it occurred to me yesterday watching the TV that the pictures of men and women in Congress hiding under their desks by a gunman, these are the same people who've refused to pass legislation so our school children don't have to hide from gunmen in America. Pre-COVID, kids face that every day, and she hopes their experience yesterday at least gave them new perspective. And listen to this one. This is from Flora. She said, I think it would be perfect if Mike Pence tells Trump he will pardon him if he resigns. Then Trump resigns, and Pence says, just kidding.
877-301-8970. By the way, from the this is a part answer to the caller a minute ago. This is from the Congressional Research Service. The date for this is our colleagues back in Brighton, and thank you for doing this. The date for counting the electoral votes is fixed by law as January 6th. I didn't know it was law. I thought it was Constitution. I was wrong. Following each presidential election, unless the date is changed by law. For example, when January 6th, 2013 was the fall on a Sunday, the date for counting electoral votes was changed to January 4th when the president signed so-and-so in late 2012. So I guess the answer to the prior caller's question is Congress could have changed the law on a of course, that has to be signed by Donald Trump, though. And if Donald Trump wouldn't sign the proposed law change to change the certification date from January 6th to another date, that does. So I guess we haven't answered the question. If they didn't fulfill their statutory responsibilities last night, what happens? And the answer is we still don't know. Lauren in Marblehead, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call. Hi.
Hi, Dan. I've been calling a lot lately.
And we're glad to have you. What's up?
Oh, good.
So I prefaced, I actually work at a major hospital administering oxygen, but we're out of supplies. So I'm I'm home working. So not completely, but we're getting there. I have two comments. One is a quick one, and the other one is a little more involved, but with the exception of Romney, all Republicans that enabled the lawlessness of Trump have blood on their hands relative to the current state of affairs. I feel badly for friends that are Republicans and have no home to go to in terms of voting Republican, if that's their affiliation, and somewhere to go that feels sane for them. But the other bigger point I really want to make is, and I preface this by saying I fully appreciate and support our police forces, those that are not corrupt. I was horrified yesterday to watch the passive behavior from the Capitol Police. And I saw in a New York Times segment, it's like an 8-minute segment, that it appears some of the cops are themselves from the anti-government movement.
By the way, Laura, for whatever it's worth, Lauren, Andrew Cabral said the exact same thing about 25 minutes ago, that there's a long history of police forces. No, it's fine. Being infiltrated by these very same white supremacist elements.
And they wear, for example, the three percenters.
Yeah.
A symbol on their uniforms and coordinate with them, let them pass after they harm people or shoot someone, and of course pose for photos. So I just think there's not enough of that being understood, and I feel badly for the good cops, but there's bad eggs in there too.
Thank you for the call, and I support what Andrea said. There should be an investigation. Some commission should be put together to look into them. By the way, you'll appreciate this. Talk about double entendre. As Lauren was just talking, I looked at Drudge to see if there was any update on Donald Trump's tweeting or whatever. The headline under an interesting picture of Trump is certifiable, which I think is perfect. Is it not? That is really, in so many ways, that is really good one. 877-301-8170. I'm sorry. What?
Lauren talked about Republicans having blood on their hands. Mm-hmm. Josh Hawley, who was the first one to say he was going to object to the votes in the Senate, he's from Missouri. Apparently, the Kansas City newspaper, his own hometown newspaper, said that in their editorial that he has blood on his hands.
Really?
What happened yesterday. Yes.
Well, as you mentioned, people have to Google that photograph if they haven't seen it, with his fist held high in the air, basically saying power to the demonstrators who became rioters there, and he's probably singing a different tune today.
And interestingly enough, when people came to his house to protest, and I'm not keen, I don't know where you are on this, Jim, on people going to people's houses and vandalizing them. I think it's probably not a good idea. But in any case, he claimed it was Antifa banging on his door over and over again. It's like everything that happens now.
When did they go to his house, by the way? Antifa. You mean since this?
No, before this.
Oh, okay.
Not before this happened, and his wife was in there with a newborn baby, and he was very upset about it. He blamed it on Antifa, and he said everybody was banging on the door. The video showed that they were not banging on the door, but they were at his house. But when I've been to protests and when I've seen Antifa people, they're very easy to pick out because they're all in black. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all in black, and they're usually young men who seem like they're coordinating in terms of their outfits, and what they're there for is
they're color coordinated, by the way, because pearls look great with black.
Yeah,
outfits.
And they're anti-fascist. That's their thing. They're against fascism, so they have not been fans of President Trump. Sheila from Norton.
Hey, Sheila.
Is this
how
our
you?
Sheila that we
it
know?
Is.
Sheila.
I think it is. Hi, Sheila.
Oh my
not.
Goodness.
Hi, Sheila.
Yeah, very nice to talk to you. And I knew you'd have a great show today. And I really love Andrea Cabral.
She's great.
Tell her.
She's just a gem. And people should follow her tweets. They are terrific.
They're
so
great.
I'll tell your audience that.
By the way, she's got a really odd handle, and it's spelled weirdly. You have to Google
yes.
Andrea Cabral, and then you'll find out what her Twitter handle is. But go ahead, Sheila.
Yeah, she's terrific. And on a lighter note, I think antacids officially have a street value now after yesterday, because there's no way we can get them at a CVS. What a scary time. And I'm one of these people who actually could feel it physically yesterday. And
yeah.
I have a question for you guys, two questions, and I'll leave you to talk about it. But could it ever be that this is have you no decency, a decency moment?
Yeah.
Do you think that... we finally reached what Jim has always said we are hoping we'd reach before. Have we reached that point? And secondly, do you think that there's been a chilling effect on the police officers or any kind of security to do something to a protester for fear that they will have repercussions as to why they acted in the way they did? For instance, I guess they say this victim was not armed. And I'm not sure I believe a police officer did shoot her in the chest from what they say in the news.
That's what I've read, yeah.
And I'm just wondering if, I don't know what they should have done, to be honest, to protect the state of the Capitol. And if they did shoot at someone, would they have been tried for that? I really don't know where we are with whether or not we can protect places now. And I'm not saying someone should shoot at a demonstrator. I just don't know what is... a form of protection that we can rely on.
Well, can I answer the second one quickly while you're there? By the way, for those who, the three people who are, have you no decency, sir, is obviously Joseph Welch from the McCarthy hearings, from those who don't recall. The answer is it didn't have to get to that point. I mean, if this is the answer to your question, Sheila, they should have been prepared for this. Every one of us lay people knew that something like this was very possible. All you had to do was check social media. And if they didn't want it to happen and they didn't want to welcome them in, they could have gotten reinforcements, which they later ultimately did, that would have caused none of this to happen. At least that's my sense. But Sheila, it's great to talk to you as always
yes,
and hear from you. Thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, you know, when you see these, when you saw the National Guard people and the cops last night standing in formation around mm-hmm. the Capitol, you thought there's an impressive show of force there. Probably nothing is going to happen. Early in the day, you saw one Capitol policeman being run over by 25 protesters. So obviously, they hadn't planned very well for this whole thing. Anyway, coming up, we're going to check in with Congressman Bill Keating about the chaos he experienced when the Capitol was overrun by an angry mob yesterday. Bill Keating joins us next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We'll get back to more of your calls in a few minutes. But first, yesterday, Congress formally validated Joe Biden's presidential win after the time-honored ceremony was disrupted by those rioters running rampant in the Capitol. Congressman Bill Keating was forced to take cover in his office when this happened. He joins us in line to talk about that and how Democrats are now calling to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove Donald Trump. Congressman Keating, good to talk to you. Thanks for calling in.
Well, Jim, great to be with you again, and Marjorie as well.
Yes, thank you very much, Congressman. So what happened yesterday? Where were you when you knew that things were getting out of control? And give us the details.
Well, I was, one of the unintended consequences of the COVID-19 response that we have is we're practicing social distancing on the floor. And one of the results of that is there weren't many members on the floor. Certainly not what they usually would be. So that was fortunate. But we'd rotate in and rotate out. I was beginning to go from my office over to the Capitol. And while I was walking there, we have an emergency system, you know, on our phones for alerts with the Capitol Police. First, immediately came in that the Madison building, part of the Library of Congress, was to be evacuated immediately. And then just a minute or so later, it was the Cannon House office building, one of the three House office buildings for members of Congress. And the alert was members and staff immediately evacuate the Cannon building and go to the building I was leaving. So I began to catch on here that I better stay where I am. And indeed, just the moments after that, there was a shelter-in-place order by the Capitol Police to stay in your office, stay away from windows, and lock your doors. And there's other emergency security items we have there that, you know, best left not known publicly, but something that we're aware of. And that all happened within just several minutes as I was going over there. And then it became clear what was going on with the breach of security, the fact that the Capitol had been breached, something that no one anticipated, no one could think possible. It's one of those things we picture in a movie, you know, those usually B-rated movies or something where someone tries to take over the government and they have these scenes of the Capitol being taken over. And only this time it was for real.
Were you scared, Congressman Keating?
No, I sort of take things in my mind one stage at a time, just the way I am, but... interesting enough, the afternoon before, the protesters were, they were protesters the afternoon before. There was no violence, but they had started to form. And we had a 2-hour break, and I like to take a walk, in my mind, walk outside. And, you know, I'm always intrigued, as you two know, on law enforcement matters. I went to Sochi to see how the Russians, you know, from a homeland security perspective, were handling their security for a big event. So I started talking to the Capitol police officers, walked to talk to the D.C. police officers, even the Supreme Court police officers, and I kept asking, so what do you have planned? Have you made extensive plans? Where's the perimeter going to be set? I wanted to know for the next morning. And they were making plans. They were confident at that stage. They said, we've got it taken care of. They told me what the perimeter would be, which would be several blocks away. And so that was my understanding the afternoon before. Well, that day, it was clear that perimeter, and that's how you deal with security, in rings. Mm-hmm. And so the furthest rings, they had just put basically metal, movable barriers.
Right.
That some people used as ladders to help climb up on the Capitol later on, and they were easily breached. So immediately they were in the plaza, and that's trouble because the Capitol Police were far outnumbered at that point, and it was a situation of just trying to get the control you can exert, but they clearly lost the ability to control at that point.
We're talking to Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating. One last thing about what congresspeople and senators did. I was listening to one of your colleagues, I think it was on CBS late last night, Susan Wild from Pennsylvania, who I'm sure you know, and she described being taken to a secure location with, she said, hundreds of your colleagues in a fairly small space. She wouldn't say where it was because for obvious reasons. And she said that one of the things she was appalled by, she didn't use the word appalled, but she was appalled, was that a significant number of Republican members of Congress in that very those very tight quarters, particularly brand new Republican members of Congress, were unmasked. Have you heard anything about that? And she was very worried about end up being a super spreader event. Had you heard about that? And do you have concerns about that?
I have concerns about it. Frankly, a few months ago when we were first returning after the summer break, I went back to the chamber for votes. And frankly, I looked at the out-of-television view of the Republican members, and they were all huddled in the back with no masks after there was a requirement to wear masks in the chamber itself. And at that point, I went to the sergeant-at-arms staff connected to the speaker, and I said, look, I'm going to hand out masks and confront them myself if you don't do your job. And frankly, that did work, and they confronted them. But I also know technical people, IT people that go into offices. Again, it happens to be Republican offices where the staff is at full constitution and no masks. And they walk out and set up back when you have masks. So that's not surprising. There's still people that view that as their freedoms. Indeed, the several hundred people I saw that Tuesday before the riot on the Capitol that were protesting outside the Supreme Court, I didn't see one of those people with masks. So there is definitely, as you're probably aware, in my mind, a political connection to freedom. Yeah. Government should tell me what to do. I'm not wearing a mask. So that does not surprise me.
We're talking with Congressman Bill Keating. Congressman, I wonder whether you think we know that about half of the senators that were going to object to the certification of the votes yesterday changed their mind. It ended up being, there was originally 13, I think it was 6 and maybe 7 in one case. What do you think about your colleagues in the House, their reaction to this violence? A lot of them went ahead to object to the certification despite the mess.
After this all occurred, over half the Republicans still voted not to certify Joe Biden as president of the United States, Kamala Harris as vice president. They still did that. They pushed two roll calls. Another was attempted, but at that point, they couldn't get a senator to sign on. So it continues. And I do think it's significant because, look, there was an insurrection going on outside the building on Wednesday into Thursday. But there was another type of insurrection going on inside the building. And that was the senators and the Republicans who, with no evidence whatsoever, after 60 court cases led to nothing, were going to perpetuate the myth that this election was a fraud and take it to the extreme of not honoring a free and fair election, the core of our democracy. So I heard a lot of outcries after the riots occurred, a lot of backtracking and rehabilitation of reputations. And I saw all that occur, but it struck me as, look, as someone decrying the flame and still holding the match.
Hey, Congressman Keating, I read your tweet, and I'm sure you've said this since, joining a lot of your colleagues who think it's time for the 25th Amendment, and this is the Section 4 that has never been used that says that if a vice president, a majority of his of the president's cabinet or some subgroup of Congress, which I guess is ill-defined, communicate the inability of the president, according to them, to fulfill his duties, he is at least temporarily removed and he has some recourse for appeal. Is this a political statement, or is there a snowball's chance in hell that Trump doesn't survive his last 13 days in office?
It's been used, Jim, for when someone's under surgery or for...
No, not the fourth section, not Section 4.
Not in this 4. Not in this respect. Honestly, there are quite credible and numerous reports that within the Trump administration itself at high levels, they are having those discussions now. And so I view my efforts, I think it's appropriate, all things considered, it's appropriate. It's the right measure to do. I think he's clearly a threat at this point to our democracy, and he should be removed from office because of that threat. The implementation of that is something that's going to be, if it ever would occur, really in the hands of the vice president, the high cabinet level officials, majority of them. The chances of that are not great. But to the extent that we provide at least our voice and our opinion as to what, you know, what should be done, if that could ever affect the vice president of the cabinet, who might be seeing things and more concerned about things than we're aware of, then I think it offers that support. So I think it has that amount of tangible benefit to it. Put to the question, asked and answered, that I do think it's appropriate. But I don't have great confidence that the vice president of the cabinet will be able to do that in the period of 13 days.
You know, when you talk, and obviously it would need, beyond the vice president, I was going to talk about, let's talk about your Republican colleagues for a second. Marjorie and you were talking about the significant number who voted for the objections. When you talk to these people, in I just find it almost impossible to believe that, one, they believe that the election was stolen, and two, that they believe that this president deserves support if you actually care about this nation. Am I wrong? Or do they really believe this sickness that they embrace, or is it a self-protecting political act on their part, Congressman?
It's both. There are members clearly that just say, you know, this is not worth the abuse I'm going to take, the threat of a primary next time, just for the short period of appeasing the president. But I must tell you, I think there are probably just as many members that truly believe this, that are all part of that mindset, and they're there hook, line, and sinker, and are committed to it. So that's the thing that people ask me quite often and have asked me before these recent events is, do they really think so, or are they just doing it for political reasons? And I must say, I would say at least half, if not the majority of the people, have these core beliefs and these core feelings. And you might find that disturbing, but that's what I've...
I do find it disturbing, and I'm sure you do, too. We're talking to Congressman Bill Keating.
Congressman, since you're not the only one who thinks the 25th Amendment, or you know, getting rid of the president officially before the inaugural is you know, hard to pull off, a lot of us are hoping, and maybe naively, that there are people around him. I mean, we heard reports today about his aides trying endlessly to get him to call off the violence yesterday, and he would have none of it, and they couldn't get this tweet out until the wee hours of the morning and stuff like that. That there are people, you know, it's like Nixon back in Watergate when Nixon was supposedly drinking heavily in the last days, and
final days.
And people got together and said, we're not going to, you know, the military guys, Pentagon guys, defense guys, people in the cabinet, you know, make sure he doesn't like pull the button on, you know, nuclear war or something. That there are people around the president, this president, doing the same thing to make sure he doesn't go off the deep end. Do you think that's true?
I don't think it's as true as it was during the Nixon era, where there were other people surrounding Nixon. It's great to hear those stories today by David Gergen and other people where that actually did occur. I have some confidence in the military side. I think the chair, the Joint Chief, General Milley, I have a feeling, working with him on Armed Services Committee and things, and learning from his experience in Lafayette Square, you recall how he came back after that humiliating experience there for him, and he stood up and he said, I was wrong, I shouldn't have been there, there's no place in the military. And we've had, I believe, 10 former secretaries of defense on record bolstering the idea that they're concerned during this period. So I have some confidence on the military side. I have less confidence with the other people that are surrounding him because he's just hollowed them out. They're not there anymore. The Jim Mattis, who came out with a strong statement yesterday condemning what happened in the Capitol and taking direct aim at the president and the responsibility he has to bear for that, he resigned. He was pushed out. So I'm concerned about the cast of characters who are around him right now not being strong, being yes people. People that, you know, tell him what he wants to hear, the Stephen Millers of the world. So I think these are the things that concern me. But when it comes to the military side, I have a little bit, a great deal, frankly, more confidence that that's the case. And I would like to see in the world of all worlds, Mitch McConnell go up with, to the White House, the way Dirksen did and other people did that day, and have a heart-to-heart with him and tell him what's going on, and try and get some moderation, particularly leading up to this inauguration in the light of what happened Wednesday to Thursday with the insurrection in the Capitol and now an inauguration occurring. I would like to think that would happen, and I would like to think it would have effect, and I'm not sure it would.
You know, Congressman,
inauguration. could be a very tense day, Congressman.
It will be tenser after yesterday, certainly. I mean, look, this is this should be the most secure place in our country, and it's clearly a target. It was allegedly one of the targets on 9/11,
right,
the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. There are all kinds of efforts, and it was always looked as the hardest of the hard targets. Yes, you know, this was revealed to be a soft target, and that can't continue. And if that's a soft target, then the inauguration could be a soft target.
Yeah.
You know, after 9/11, if you moved around the Capitol area, the people were on guard. They were worried about extremist activities. And as we know now, with our own Homeland Security reports, that we do have extremist threats in this country, but they're white supremacist extremist threats. We have domestic extremist threats in this country as well, too. And we should be prepared for them as well. So we have work to do. I can tell you this, that the discussions and the analysis started last night and into this morning, and there's going to be changes. And there's questions that have to be answered about the movement of the National Guard. I have pretty good information that there was an effort to have the Guard be more activated and involved during the day as things transpired, and there was a significant delay in that happening, and it was only when Vice President Pence himself intervened and called it that they were called into, you know, direct action, not just the backup type capacity.
Congressman Keating, I have one last thing for you. We've talked to you in prior calls about some of your travels through your foreign affairs seat and that sort of thing around the world. How much damage has been done to our reputation, and what's the consequence of that around the world, the beacon of liberty and democracy and all those kinds of things? I don't just mean by yesterday, even though yesterday was the exclamation mark, but by Trump's attempt to subvert democracy for such a long period of time. How much harder is it for us to do what you believe we need to do around the world?
One of my personal missions that I brought on myself 2 years ago when I became chair of the Committee on Foreign Affairs, the subcommittee chair in that broad expanse of Europe, Eurasia, was to try and fulfill that void. And it's more than a void. You got to understand that the view of the United States has had enormous damage thrust upon it. And I always am cognizant of the fact that the officials in the other country, and I've met over 300 officials in these 2 years, and I took it as a personal mission to at least do everything I could formally and officially so that they knew the view of the United States was not the view they were getting from the President of the United States. And the damage is significant. And I understand, too, many of those officials are elected. And in Germany, for instance, a poll just in the last year or so showed an unfavorability rate towards Americans of 80%.
Wow.
We were lower than the Chinese. And if that's reflected on the people that these officials represent, it has significance. And the officials that I have great relations with and speak with on a biweekly basis, many of them, these people are our friends, and they tell us it's heartbreaking. They say, I know what's going on. It's terrible in your country right now. But we need you. These are Western democratic countries, and they say, we need the United States. We need your influence. We need your democracy. We need the beacon, as Jim just described it. You're the beacon of democracy. And when we are in times of trouble here and facing these kinds of challenges, we need you there. And we've been missing in action, and worse. We've insulted those leaders. We pulled troops away at a fit of anger because Angela Merkel didn't come to a G7 meeting, and all of a sudden our troops are being pulled out of Germany, which has strategic and relationship effects of great magnitude. All the pettiness that they've suffered through, but they were waiting. They were waiting, hoping there would be a change. And having someone like Joe Biden, rich in foreign policy experience, where he used to chair the committee in the Senate side, will be welcome. But there's been enormous damage. And then Wednesday and Thursday, another kind of damage that I think was jaw-dropping to the people around the world to see such an iconic and secure seat of government in the United States just get breached like that. And they get the television. This was the lead story around the world, these films, of what was happening in the United States. And we've given China, where we try to take the high ground with the Uyghurs, the high ground with what's going on in Hong Kong. We try in Belarus speak up for the fact that elections are not legitimate, and speaking up with the opposition for democracy there. It's been pretty hard to take that tack as I have and do it in the backdrop of what's happening in your own country. So, Jim, you're right on point. This has significant effect, not just diplomatically, but to our security, to our economic benefit. Sometimes we don't appreciate how we've been viewed in the world. And that's since I've been a congressman, it's one of the things that surprised me. It shouldn't have, I guess, just how revered and respected the U.S. is as you go around the world. And then how necessary our place is to these other countries. And the damage has been severe, and it took another big blow with what happened in the Capitol on Wednesday.
Bill Keating, we're glad you're safe. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Congressman. Congressman Bill Keating is chairman of Europe, Eurasia, Energy, and the Environment Subcommittee and senior member of the Armed Services Committee. He represents the state's 9th congressional district. Okay, from now until 2 o'clock, we're opening up the lines to continue our conversation with you. The phone number, again, 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. We're talking, of course, about what happened yesterday. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As Marjorie said a minute ago, until the end of the show at 2 o'clock, it is all yours at 877-301-8970. We can talk about the insurrection at the Capitol yesterday, the vote at 3:30 in the morning to certify the results of the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, or you can talk about your hopes or fears going forward as a result of yesterday's behavior, 13 days yet to go in the presidency of Donald Trump, unless he's removed or chooses to remove himself. 877-301-8970. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's start with Kathleen, who's calling from California.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks
Welcome.
For calling.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I wanted to thank you for asking John King my filibuster question.
Oh, you're the one who broached it the other day. Thank you. Thanks for broaching.
Yes, and I'm still worried about it because if the Democrats don't get it together to change the rules on the first day, we're going to be out of luck. There's other things besides the filibuster that have to be cleaned up.
But Kathleen, before you continue, Kathleen called the other day and said, the problem is, even with 50 votes plus Vice President Harris's tie-breaking vote, now that the Democrats have won Georgia, most things you need 60 votes. And we did a little checking. Not only did we talk to John King, but our colleagues, Kathleen, did a little research. And the exception, as we touched upon but weren't sure about, are these budget reconciliation procedures, which only require a majority, 50% plus one. And having done a little research on ourselves, as long as an issue, even if it's a policy issue, someone yesterday called about immigration and the Dreamers, the DACA program, as long as there's a budgetary impact, budget reconciliation can be used, and the 50-vote threshold would apply. So it's not quite as dire as you suggested, but we're really glad you raised the issue.
Yeah, but there are other parts of the Senate rules that need to be cleaned up, like how long you can wait before you call a confirmation hearing and stuff like that. You know, I know everyone thinks that what happened yesterday was the coup, but the real coup goes on by stealth in the Senate. by McConnell's abuse of the rules consistently, whether he's the majority leader or the minority leader. And, you know, the Democrats' reluctance to hold Republicans accountable for their stuff is why we got as outrageous as we did yesterday. He should have been impeached for everything the Judiciary Committee wanted to impeach him for. And I'm sorry to disagree with Lawrence Tribe, but he was wrong when he advised the Democrats only to bring one article of impeachment. The second article was like a bone to the Judiciary Committee, but not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And we appreciate
I wanted Speaker Pelosi to bring all the articles of impeachment and to pull her own Merrick Garland and not deliver them to the Senate until after the people spoke and we had a new session of Congress. She could have done that, but she didn't because she's too nice.
Kathleen, thank you for your call. We got to go. We got it. We got it. A lot of people believe that the Democrats, Republicans play politics by one set of rules, and the Democrats historically play by a far kinder and gentler set of rules. But now they control both houses, even though narrowly. Let's see how they do play. Thanks for your call, as always, Kathleen. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to, I don't know where we're going.
Alfred and Lincoln.
Alfred and Lincoln, thank you.
Hello there. Hello, Alfred. Can you hear me? We
hear you. Oh, no, my line. Yeah. Hello.
Let's see. I'm not sure the connection is great. Oops, you're now on hold. We'll get back to you in a second. They're trying to work out the connection. 877-301-8970. While we're working on that, we're going to Rhode Island, where Jason is. Hi, Jason.
Hi, great to hear from you guys. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for holding the show today.
Pleasure.
Yeah, I just wanted to share with your audience something that that a reporter whose work I've been following over the last couple of years, who saw this coming from a couple of miles off, who's Leah Sottile. She's an independent journalist who did a phenomenal podcast that I would highly encourage your listeners to follow called Bundyville.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
And Bundyville, if you guys haven't checked this out, this absolutely is something that is worth, you know, pausing today and listening to in its entirety, because she's been on this kind of the patriot movement, the beat of domestic terrorism for the last several years, starting with Malheur in 2016. And in that regard, you know, that event was largely laughed off by the press as something that, well, this is some fringe Oregon thing that's happening out west. And really the seeds for what we saw happen yesterday have been in the works for a long time. And I think the headline here is that we have looked abroad for terrorists for the last, you know, understandably for the last 20 years without fully, you know, coming to grips with our own history. I mean, this is Oklahoma City, you know, not to be alarmist, but I think that there is a deep streak of domestic terrorism that we saw play out yesterday in a way that was unfathomable to some, but visible from a mile out for many who've been covering this.
We'll check the podcast. And by the way, I'm so glad you used that term, and I feel bad that we did not.
What, domestic terrorism?
A couple of analysts who I heard last night did use the term that Jason did, and I think that fits perfectly much of what happened yesterday. Well, Jason, thanks for the recommendation. We'll follow up on it and let people know. Thank you. Bundyville.
Many people have talked about the fact that white supremacy is a big, growing problem, and these people that infiltrate the cops, and they infiltrate prison guards, and they infiltrate other places, and that there are these whole groups that are on the rise. But, you know, earlier in the show, and this is not obviously to forgive anything that these people do and what they did yesterday, someone emailed, and I didn't get a chance to read it, but he was talking about how the Democrats have ignored, and Hillary Clinton did, large degree, the economic crisis that is all around the country in these places where they've lost manufacturing jobs, they've lost work, and, you know, that brings us to the sorry state of affairs where vast numbers of Americans don't even have $400 for an emergency. And the Democrats do have to be a lot better about that, because they have been in league with money elites too much for my money. And there is when you can't hold on a job and you can't feed your family, this is not to excuse anything, but it creates, obviously, big-time problems. And I think we're seeing that in some of these really odd groups.
Well, by the way, for whatever it's worth, a story I read this morning about Georgia, was saying that one of the reasons, beyond the spectacular work of Stacey Abrams and the overwhelming support of black voters in Georgia that Ossoff and Warnock won, is that in the regular election, the one that led to the runoff, they're talking about a whole host of things. In this election, the runoff, they focused on the economy, and a lot of people were thought it was crass. I mentioned yesterday one of the bumper stickers for Warnock was
great.
Won a $2,000 check,
yeah.
Vote Warnock. Now, it happens to be true. It is very likely that with the 50 votes plus Harris, that the additional $2,000 stimulus check is going to become law, and people are going to get that check, and it may be seen as crass. But it was an economic message that at least the analysts in Georgia felt was very successful. Well, the flip side of that, Marjorie, is the woman who's probably going to be the Treasury Secretary, the American people are going to hear a lot in the hearings, took $7 million in speaker's fees from financial institutions, Wall Street, etc., in the 2 years that Janet Yellen was out in the private sector. I mean, that does that concern you at all?
Well, it concerns me if the fact that she took that money fogs her vision and she can't see
well,
that
she says
a real,
it won't, of course.
She says it won't, of course. She shouldn't have done it. I guess you could say she shouldn't have done it. But I mean, I think it's time to realize that trickle-down economics does not work, that you can't keep giving tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans. You can't keep letting corporations run roughshod. You can't expect people to survive when we don't raise the federal minimum wage so people can earn
which
a living.
Biden also says he's going
to
do.
Two and three jobs to, yep. just to survive. I mean, all these things, it's just since Reagan, and I know lots of people love Ronald Reagan, but since Reagan, things have gotten worse and worse and worse for the middle class in America. And I think that both parties, including the Democrats, have been lousy about addressing that.
By the way, Marjan, people do not know what the federal minimum wage is today. It's $7.25.
Yeah, $7.
Which is just, it is...
I mean, you see states trying to make up for some of this. You know, we've raised the minimum wage here. Other places have raised the minimum wage.
A lot of states.
But it's just, you know, I've said this a million times, but why not say it one more time, Marjorie, that, you know, there was a time in the United States of America, and it was in the heyday for the middle class post-World War II, where you could buy a house, you could send your kids to college, you could do these, live a middle class life with one person in the family earning the paycheck, and mothers could stay home. Mothers obviously don't always want to stay home, but very few mothers have the option to stay home anymore. And Elizabeth Warren wrote about this 30 years ago, the two-income trap. And a lot of us are stuck in that two-income trap where even two incomes doesn't get you very far. Marjan from Rockport, thank you for calling.
Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Quick question. I believe that yesterday was a diversion. I don't think he thought it was going to succeed. So what was he doing? What did he sign into law or make a presidential edict? What was he up to while the Proud Boys were distracting everybody?
Well, a lot of people think he's the master of distraction. The answer to your question
is
I have absolutely no idea. I think as crazy as I believe he is, I don't think he thought, succeed? That demonstrators, that rioters were going to cause a majority of people to vote not to certify the electoral results. He knew it wasn't going to succeed. He wants to cause chaos and be the center of attention. And Marjan, my analysis of yesterday, uninformed, but it's what I believe, is that that's what it was all about, is that have the attention turned back to him rather than Joe Biden, whose day it was. And we'll find out down the line if you sadly are right and something heinous happened under the cover of these riots. Marjan, thank you for your call. 877-301-8897. What are you laughing about?
You know, I'm with his niece. I've never believed there was any method to his madness.
Madness.
You know, this is the way he's lived his whole life. He's lied. He's cheated. He's not paid people money. He demands absolute loyalty. He turns on people. And now, for the first time in his life, and this is a niece who's a psychologist, and
Mary
she knows
Trump.
Him. She grew up in the family. It's a really good book to get some insight into the present. That this is the first time he's not been able to lie or cheat or buy his way out of a mess, and it's driving him off the deep end.
But I buy it, too. I buy the same analysis you do.
Yeah. Dan from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As shocking and as how criminal what yesterday was, I really think that the people that are really responsible for this are not going to be held accountable. And there's one example that I'd like to give that I got from watching TV today. I was watching one of those talk shows, this morning, and they had Colin Powell, and they called him on because he used to be head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he used to be Secretary of State, and he was bemoaning how they asked him specifically about, you know, Trump has nuclear numbers, you know, what could happen, and how he says, you know, you never want to get into war, you always want to talk first, war is the last thing you want to do, and then he went into how much lying Trump had done from the beginning. And these words were coming from a man who lied to the American people and to the world and got us into a war. And he was never held accountable. He's the example of people not being held accountable, and they were fawning all over him.
And by the way, for whatever it's worth, Dan, Marjorie and I have debated this for years, but let me just say, I am not terribly sympathetic. I mean, Colin Powell's statement was what turned the tide. That's what Dan is referencing. There is a school of thought that you subscribe to that believe he knew he was cooking the books, and a lot of people, including Powell himself, say he was misled. So we hear your point, but we're not going to resolve it within the confines of our show. But there is an ongoing debate about how honorable or dishonorable Secretary Powell was. Dan, thank you for your call.
But, you know, on a much smaller scale than starting a war, I mean, they escorted a lot of these people out yesterday. Why weren't they?
And let them leave.
Yeah.
Well, because as you were suggesting, there was some sympathy. I don't know. I don't know.
Should not every single person who came into the Capitol building
been arrested?
Had been arrested and be in the a courthouse this morning? And
am I right that the number of arrests as of this morning is 52? Is that
I haven't
number
checked
ring
since
a bell?
We went on the air. That
was
very the number
low.
This morning. I don't know if that's still the number, but there were many more than 52 people in there. And apparently when the police did and the National Guard did show up, they got people from the pushed people out of the building. Mm. They just let them go.
You know, it's also
broke windows
and
defaced things and went into Nancy Pelosi's office and I guess turned over desks and ripped up photographs, and they ripped up a lot of the artwork that was in the rotunda there. It surprisingly, really, there wasn't more damage done. You were surprised to see later in the day when they were back in the House and the Senate that everything looked, you know, very nice. The desks all looked great and stuff like that. But there was physical damage done, a defacement of government property.
Well,
and they broke
four,
in.
And there are four people who were dead yesterday. And by the way, we haven't had time to mention today except in passing another one of, in my view, the homicidal behaviors of this president. Is something he doesn't care about at all, is 4,000 more people died yesterday, the highest death total of the whole pandemic. 4,000, I think it was 3,900 and something people in this country died from something that this president had the power to address and didn't give a damn about. I mean, it's just, it is, yesterday was horrible. In many ways, it pales next to the 350 or 60-some thousand Americans are dead, most of whom did not need to be, if this guy cared about the people who have been his constituents for 4 years. Lewis and Dedham, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And the reason I'm calling is because this is a horrible situation what the country is going to. But we should take a look at this and look at it as a way that of the way we need to improve issues in our country. And it is a horrible thing, and this guy is definitely wrong, but I think it's an opportunity for everybody to come together and say, hey, wait a second. You know, we've experienced the best president you could have, which is George Washington, and now we're experiencing, like, the worst president you could have. And I think we have to come together and look at it and say, we got to figure out how we make that office a way that, you know, you don't get a character like this. And you don't get, and we strive for a better, you know, quality of a president.
How do we do that? So how do we, what do we do, Lewis, to get there?
So I think they definitely got to put things in place that maybe the office doesn't have to have so much power the way it does. Maybe the office, you know, you shouldn't have just one guy on the button. We got to look at a way to make it a strategic, like, you know, you got to be careful when we're giving that office to somebody. And maybe, you know, it could be something like that. And maybe it's a wake up call to the citizens. Like, you know, when you got a candidate that's making fun of a person that's handicapped, hold on, you know, that's not what we stand for. We have to kind of wake up as citizens and say, you know, we got to sit back and analyze this a little better and take it more serious when we go out and vote.
Well, I mean, Lewis, I hope the future is what you want it to be. But 74 million people, at least most of them, knew about him mocking that New York Times reporter with a disability. They knew what he said about Keyser Khan's son and about John McCain and his birtherism and Stormy Daniels and sexual assault of how many women? What's the number, Marjorie? 24?
24.
24, whatever it is. And they decided that he was perfectly fine to reelect. So I'm with you in terms of goals, Lewis, but we have a hell of a long way to go. I mean, one of the reasons Biden is elected is obviously as a counter force to what Trump was. I mean, whether he can unite the American people, I think, is really up for grabs. But he ran as a uniter. Somebody said, you know, I'm a president of all the people. And I think, while every politician says that, even Trump has said it from time to time, you do get the sense that he really means it. I just don't know if he can make it happen.
Mike in Norwood, thank you for calling.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a first-time, long-time, and I can certainly relate to just about every caller that you had over the last 4 years. But I, when it comes to the president, I think yesterday we saw it was the confluence of streams of madness and rivers of doom. I mean, literally, when you sit here and you ask, how can this happen? Every single inspector general over the last 4 years has been fired for doing their job.
It's a great point.
he dumped the entire Pentagon top brass in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Why? So you can't call up the National Guard to stop his riots. Mm-hmm. Everything he's done is calculated, and I don't even want to give him that much credit. It's almost like he's got his Cheney in there pushing the buttons, and that's the Steve Bannons and the Stephen Millers and all of these calculated evil people that have allowed something like this to happen yesterday. And nobody was on either side of the aisle was willing to stand up and say no and go and stand up and do the whole I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I mean, Joe Scarborough tried to do it this morning, and I'm sure there's going to be an FCC fine coming his way. But nobody has.
Oh, is he swearing? Said, no, was he swearing, Mike? Is that why you said that?
He went the whole kit and caboodle this morning about the cops letting people in the door. But nobody stood up and said, no, you cannot fire independent watchdogs. You cannot fire inspector generals. And everybody did, you know, the next press release I see from Chuck Schumer is going to really set me over the edge. Like, don't send out a really strongly worded letter. And I know Joe Biden wants to heal, and that's what you have to say right now, but hopefully he's going to have some people in his cabinet, and I think it sounds like there's a couple of local folks that are going to be in there pretty soon that are going to come in there and fight and fight the way that we know how, and fight the way that people around here know how to get things done.
Mike, that was a hell of a first call. I don't know what you've been waiting for. Maybe you've been storing
yeah,
it all
back,
up.
Call back, Mike.
But do call back.
Especially in the inspector generals. That was reminding us of all that.
But speaking of local, one of our colleagues says that there are per Politico's White House correspondent on Twitter, mm-hmm. That Joe Biden has chosen Marty Walsh to serve as labor secretary. That's the only source so far. Again, Politico's White House correspondent has tweeted that Biden has chosen Mayor Marty Walsh to serve as his labor secretary. We'll obviously stay on top of that, as will everybody. We got to take a break.
Okay, we're talking about what happened yesterday, whether you think it's time to invoke the 25th Amendment, given how much damage Trump could do in his remaining days as president, and what else you think about the reaction of the cops, etc. 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio. The number is 877-301-8970.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I was going to say we're just talking about yesterday, but we're really not. We're talking about yesterday and tomorrow and the future and the last 13 days of Donald Trump's presidency, assuming he isn't either removed under the 25th Amendment or chooses to resign beforehand. And now what's been added, not to the discussion, but at least to the thought process, is Politico's White House correspondent reporting that Marty Walsh is the Biden pick to be Secretary of Labor. By the way, the governor has just been asked at his press conference about it, and his response says he has not talked to Mayor Walsh today or about the labor position. I guess he means he hasn't talked to him about it at all. And he was also asked a couple of minutes ago, should Donald Trump be removed? And I'm not sure exactly what this means, but the governor's response was, we should recognize our priority is the transition. Vice President Pence should be empowered to do that. Again, I'm not 100% clear what that means, but that's what the governor had to say at his press conference a couple of minutes ago. 877-301-8970.
You know, we had a caller who just called, talking about yesterday being a diversion, wondering what the president was doing while Rome was burning, as it were.
Yep.
And she said that he was auctioning off the Arctic drilling rights up in Alaska. That's the other
thing. I think he's done that already.
Apparently he's continuing the auction yesterday. That's what she says. I have not independently checked it. But also he's making it worse for the birds. I mean, we're already losing billions of birds here. You know, who wants to lose more birds? I mean, who's against birds? Do you know what's against birds?
How is he making it worse for the birds?
Environmental regulations. Help keep the birds. I mean, the cats are doing a number on the birds, as we all know. But we don't have to make it easier for the birds.
I don't want to upset. Is it ornithologists or ornithologists? Which is the proper word?
Don't ask me.
Whatever it is, I don't want to make it bad for those people. Mm-hmm. I'm a little more concerned about the humans. And again, I care deeply about birds. I'm not quite a birder.
Well, it's all tied up with the humans, Jim. It's like pesticides and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
877-301-8970. Pam in Worcester, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a quick point. What you just said, Jim, was a good segue into it as far as the future. I had watched the entire process up until 3:30 this morning.
Wow.
And I had noticed when they all were speaking on the floor last night that Josh Hawley, unlike all of his colleagues who were speaking to their colleagues, he spoke directly into the camera, and that was clearly, in my view, a campaign speech. So stay tuned.
Well, I mean, it's the consensus was that's why he decided to lead the charge to begin with. But the question is he chastened this morning after, I think it's fair to say that while the primary blame falls on Donald Trump, I think his enablers in Congress, led by Hawley, have a bill to pay. We shall see. Pam, thank you very much for the call.
He's giving me the heebie-jeebies, that guy. By the way, the Globe is also reporting. Did you mention this, Jim?
If not,
I'll mention it, that Biden is going to nominate Gina Raimondo, the governor of Rhode Island, to be the commerce secretary.
Wow.
And the transportation secretary, Elaine Chao, this is from the Washington Post, is going to resign. She's the first to leave Trump's cabinet after this mob attack yesterday. She, of course, is married to Mitch McConnell.
Wait a second. She's leaving because of... In response to this?
It says she's the first to resign. I heard that last night, that she was thinking about this after this debacle, and that she was resigning because of that. I mean, it's only a couple of days to go. But I guess Melania's lost some of her staff, her chief of staff.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
And her press secretary. They couldn't take it anymore, I guess, working for Melania. And that's always been the big debate. I mean, some people are explaining why do people stay. Some people stay because they said if they leave, then there'll be no guardrails and Trump will just go to his darkest side, and that's their excuse for staying. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, Elaine Chao, I'll try to see if it's because of this, but that's what was reported last night.
By the way, this Walsh story is a big deal if it's true. And the Raimondo story is a pretty big... She's term limited, I believe. I'm 90% sure. But she obviously has not finished her term. And that would be quite a big deal, too. I believe with the announcement of Merrick Garland today as Attorney General, the nomination as Attorney General, the only two open seats are the two that appear to be going to New England. Commerce to Raimondo, and reportedly, according to Politico at least... I don't see the Globe reporting on this. Maybe you do.
I get an alert in my phone.
Oh, you did. To the Labor Department, which is a big, big deal if it's true. Peter in Gloucester, hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I did have a really bad reaction to seeing the police not react as they have in the past to Black Lives Matter, and I did think it was discriminatory. However, I think there's another possibility that should be considered, and I want to see what you think about it. And that is that they knew more than they put on the Capitol Police and the whole policing outfit yesterday, that if they had shown, like, very strong force against these presumably well-armed demonstrators, right? Handguns were not banned. I mean, you can't tell who has a handgun. I saw a whole lot of, you know, backpacks there yesterday. If they had had certainly strong force or possibly the threat of lethal force, drawn gun by police, I think it's very likely that that would have resulted in a bloodbath.
Well, but the point is, Peter, if I may, as I think it was Congressman Keating who says the day before yesterday, he was speaking to a lot of the law enforcement people about the perimeter. And instead of the perimeter being fences or whatever they were that were breached pretty easily, if they thought there was a threat and were worried about violence, if they confronted them in a bigger way, the answer is keep them out to begin with. Keep them out to begin with. Have enough forces there that they couldn't breach the perimeter, to use the term. And that was a decision they chose not to make, even though, as I've said 30 times on this show today, even I knew there was a great threat just by, you know, looking through social media the night before. So, but, you know, I hear you, and I don't have any law enforcement expertise. I know it's a shock to people. So maybe you're right. Peter, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
You know, Ron just emailed, and he pointed out that Trump, in his speech yesterday to his supporters, was saying how he was going to be with them. Let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm going to be with you. We'll walk down to the Capitol and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, he never did walk with any of them at all. And he, you know, he wonders, you know, why no one was upset that he wasn't with them. I guess he was back in the White House or something like that.
Well, you know who made, did you say this? You know who made fun of him yesterday? His former ally on the Drudge Report. The Don, he said, D-O-N, the Don retreats to limousine or something.
Yeah.
After he had promised that he was going to lead the march that he was encouraging them to make to the Capitol. By the way, just as an aside, I know we're focused on yesterday and the fallout from yesterday. The fallout, if Marty Walsh is leaving town, we mentioned this yesterday.
Oh, my
yesterday.
God. Big time mayor's race.
Well, and again, Kim Janey, a city councilor, becomes acting mayor, mm-hmm. if that's the case. It totally changes the race. Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell were running against Marty Walsh, not running against the mayor's office. What do they decide to do with a colleague mm-hmm. being the acting mayor? And when there's an open seat, I mean, technically, it's not opening because Janey would be filling it as the acting mayor. When it's an open seat, we've seen what's happened, as you mentioned yesterday, when there's been an open seat in the past. The answer is virtually everybody in Boston runs. So we could have a hell of an election. Yep. It's this year when the election happens. So this is, if it's true, going to be the repercussions are going to be huge, you know?
Jeff, it must be Marty's star turn, don't you think? In the city, the Wiseman documentary about the city of Boston, that must have been the reason.
I'm sure it didn't hurt. The movie's gotten great reviews. I don't know if Biden and he have a pretty decent relationship, as we know. We used to joke with Walsh.
And he was one of the early supporters.
Well, he was not an early endorser this time. We asked him repeatedly on the show.
He was not an early endorser. That's true.
And he said, "Not yet, not yet, not yet." Plus the fact that the AFL-CIO, the leading labor organization in the country, was public about their support of Walsh. And the feeling was, as we said yesterday, this was explained well in a Globe story the other day, that Labor Secretary Sue from California, who is an Asian American, had a really good chance at the job, not only because she's supposedly really competent and good, but because the Asian American Pacific Islander Caucus in Congress was putting a lot of pressure on Joe Biden to have a Pacific Islander or Asian American in his cabinet. But it appears, according to Politico, that Marty Walsh won out. Let's go to Georgia, I believe. Augusta, and Jeff is on the phone. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
How you doing?
First time, long time.
Good. Thank you.
Good, thanks for taking my call.
Great.
A couple quick points. I do think that we're kind of glancing over the fact that the Georgia election took place, and I do wanted to say how glad I am to never, ever see Kelly Loeffler, hopefully ever again. I think that we owe a debt of gratitude to Stacey Abrams, as well as the WNBA team that she owns, the Atlanta Dream. I think back in August of this past year, Kelly Loeffler said that the BLM movement was a Marxist organization. And after that team began to actively campaign against her and took Raphael Warnock from a 9% polling to overtake her in the election. So I think that we owe a debt of gratitude to them.
Jeff,
as well.
Before you leave that, not only did her players on the team she owns oppose her, I believe the players went to the commissioner of the WNBA and asked that she be expelled as an owner of of the team. They were tough. I mean, they really they were tough. But go ahead, Jeff.
They did. It was great to see. My other point was about yesterday, obviously very, very tragic for our country, but I do think that's a kind of the a byproduct of the abuse of the pardon power that we've seen Trump wield. I think if you commit a crime on behalf of the president, you can expect to be forgiven for that crime. So I think a lot of these folks who did this were expecting, and maybe still do expect, to get a pardon. And I don't see it.
Boy, I never thought of that.
Out of the question. You can just issue blanket pardons for all these people. These are federal crimes, and he can just say, "You are all pardoned." As my final act as president, I'm going to pardon these 54 people who were arrested, and bye.
Hey Jeff, before you go, how does it feel to have been part of the electorate that Joe Biden a Democratic majority? Well, a majority with the vice president in the Senate. What's that feel like as a voter?
Oh, I wish I could say I was a part of that. I'm actually in the Army and I'm stationed down here. But I voted in Rhode Island. So, yeah, I didn't get the vote in Georgia, but I was every 10 minutes there was a new Leffler ad and it just got more and more racist. And I was just, it was more and more insufferable just here every single day. So I'm just glad to see her finally gone. But
Jeff, we're glad you called. Call us again. Thanks
I'm
so
glad
much
she's
for
gone
your
too.
Time.
She was an embarrassment to my sex, if you ask me. Okay, we are done for the day. Thank you very much, Jim. Thank you very
me?
Much for listening.
Thank me?
I don't know why I thanked you.
I have an obligation to be here, but thank you. Yeah. You're welcome. I really thank you for your kindness.
You did a spectacular job.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you for tuning in. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by Congressman Seth Moulton. We'll get his take on what happened, and we'll hear from our Friday All-Stars what happened yesterday, obviously, and the 25th Amendment stuff that our delegation is talking about. We'll hear from our Friday All-Stars as well, Callie Crossley, Emily Rooney, and Andy Anacco. We want to thank, of course, our hardworking crew, Chelsea Mers, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, our engineer, John McClaw Parker, our engineers who keep our remote studios running, Miles Smith, and Dave Goldstein. We missed you last night on TV, Jim. I hope you're going to be back tonight.
I am, as a matter of fact. Two congresspeople joining me, Lori Trahan and Catherine Clark. Catherine Clark being part of the Democratic leadership in the House to talk about yesterday, talk about the 25th Amendment, and talk about what the future looks like with Democrats in control of both houses of Congress. So two Congress people with me for the whole show tonight.
That'd be great. Okay, I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Joe. By the way, I feel I have an obligation. Thank you very much for coming today. I feel since you said it to
me. I think guys did a spectacular
job
today.
Thank you. Thank
you.
I hope you come again tomorrow. I mean, it's up to you, but I really hope you do. Take care.
Well, if I don't come, you can talk nonstop. You don't have to worry about me talking.
I plan to do that anyway. Uh-huh. See you tomorrow. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.